Good morning, everyone. Thank you for taking your time on a Saturday to come out and help us with this process. Since we are shy on participation, can we get some of you guys to move up a little closer here so we can get the crowd maybe up closer to the whole process before we get underway? Thank you very much. While you're moving the tables, I just want to again thank you for taking the time to come out today. And the logistics in the facility are that we have bathrooms outside the door and to the right, and there's a couple off of the hallway down here. We've got a real full program, so we're not going to have a scheduled break. You may have noticed in the agenda package that we don't have a break scheduled in here for you. And we just want you to get up, get something to eat if you want, use the bathrooms, get a drink of water. Hope everybody has their cell phones turned off. And with that, I want to ask if Mayor Dave Romero could come up and just give us a few words before we get started here this morning. Thank you.
Well, good morning. I hope things don't echo too much in here. I presume people are just sleeping in today and they'll show up later on. I want to welcome all of you, if you're from out of town, to San Luis Obispo. We always welcome you, particularly at our new Costco. So come and shop when you get through with the session today. And those of you who are from San Luis Obispo, welcome to Grace Church. Grace Church decided last year that they would be part of the community, and so this facility is available now for many meeting events like this. In any event, San Luis Obispo is pleased to be the central city of this county and pleased to be part, the center of all the activities. Personally, I'm very much in favor of the program that we're starting on now, the 2050 planning study. Because one of the weaknesses we've all had in our area is not looking far enough ahead. The politics are such that politicians turn over quickly. They don't look ahead very far because things won't happen during their terms. And so we need to think ahead so that by the time we get to the year 2050, we will have developed our communities in an appropriate fashion. So thank you for your interest in coming out, and we're very happy to host this meeting here in San Luis Obispo.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate that very much. I want to go down the little list I've got of folks to thank who've contributed to making this all come together for us. I want to start off with Aaron Arlen-Janay from APCD. She's not here this morning, and Dave Church as well from LAFCO, who've been working with this program last spring when we got started. Jim Lopes from County Planning was worked with us last spring as well. I don't think he's here this morning either. A large group from the county staff helped us put this on, and the next several meetings, that includes Pat Beck, Chuck Stevenson, I mentioned Jim, John Ufrat's here, Marsha Lee, who I don't think is here, Dana Lilly, there he is, did a lot of work for us, and Brenda Auerkirk from the Ag Commissioner's Office. And Brenda is way back over there. She'll be speaking a little later on. Walt Bremer and Alan Hopkins from the GIS lab at Cal Poly. You'll see the maps on the walls and the maps on the tables, the little map atlases that we put together. It's going to be the basis of our work into next spring on this. And then those folks who've helped us with some of the presentations. John Dunn and Mike Manchek from EVC, looking at some of the economic issues. Jim Grant and Bill Statler from the County of San Luis Obispo and the City of San Luis Obispo on the fiscal issues with our governmental agencies. Ray Belknap, former director at the Land Conservancy, who stepped in at the last minute because Brian Stark had to be out of town today. And then I want to note and thank Julian Crocker, who we were going to have an education component with this, but when we the legacy that's left behind, we're not going to, you know, be able to accurately predict what it's going to be like that far out. But that's the framework we want our thinking to be around. You know, we do our best predicting some of the shorter term stuff, and we have a hard enough time at that. But it's the framework for thinking that we want to drive towards with the notion of community 2050 and what our community is going to be like. The next slide we have here shows California some roughly 70 years ago, and it doesn't show up very well. We might be able to play with the lights here and dim this a little bit if we can. There aren't too many of us here that can remember 70 years ago, but it really wasn't that long ago, and that's what that area of San Fernando Valley looked like. And if you look at the ridgeline at the back of this picture, and you look at the ridgeline in this photo here, you see how much things have changed in that 70 years. And we know that change is coming to our area, and we're certainly hoping it's not going to look like this. In fact, there are a lot of people here who are still connected to that community in Southern California. And while I'm sure there's a lot of great things about it, it's just not the community we want to become in San Luis Obispo. So we went through a process last fall and spring and held some public workshops in which we looked at what some of our values were around these issues and started to frame where we're headed. What we did was we came through with a whole lot of summary concepts from those workshops. And when you look at what those things have to tell us, we are following through in a lot of those areas already. What we're really looking at is how can we better coordinate on those issues as we move forward. Because the availability of natural resources, people want development adjacent to communities. They want infill and compact development to occur. They want more housing closer to jobs. And they're also looking at affordable housing. That's been a major discussion in our community over the past several years as we've seen the median price move past $550,000. Again, they wanted jobs closer to housing and intensify existing downtowns and commercial areas, some of the trends that we're beginning to see, especially here in San Luis Obispo. Open space and agricultural land preservation is a highly valued concern. And the buffers that separate communities are what people want to see us maintain. And the county's going to talk a little bit about some of their efforts moving in that regard. And, of course, scenic views as well. So what came out of this were what our next steps were going to be. And I clicked one click faster than I had planned to there, but what you see in the red box up above there is the stage we're at now. We're beginning this effort of collaborating on a regional-based planning effort to look at how these things come together. And the reason we're here as the Central Coast component today is we want to look at the county in the smaller subsections that seem to operate as independent units as part of our whole. That is the North County, the South County, the Central Area, and the North Coast. They all have distinct characteristics and features and values that we're looking to incorporate into this overall countywide program or regional program, as we call it. So to start that process, we've worked at identifying stakeholders, and as we can see today, we didn't get as many out as we had hoped for this initial kickoff. But we've worked together with our elected officials, and we plan to continue working with them as a steering committee to move this agenda forward. So again, we're sort of kicking things off today here in this central area, and we're hoping we're going to be able to build some momentum towards our efforts next year. This chart shows in a graphic form, the essence of what our grant application is to the state under what's called the blueprint program. So blueprint funding is what we're looking to move forward with next spring in this process. We're looking to try to define much greater direction out of what we come up with today as we move into that process, and look to move those towards planning concepts and financial resources, defining how we're going to pay for those things that we want, and look at a structure to move forward with from there. So we are looking at developing a regional comprehensive vision, one that entails looking at what are our regional priorities, how we're going to establish some policies to try to pull those activities together amongst and between our agencies, and look at a strategy for regional infrastructure needs to finance those, because that's one of the key things that we face at the Council of Governments in terms of transportation. The cities face on a daily basis in a number of arenas, the county as well, through the vast area that they have to be responsible for. So with that, today's agenda, you have in your packet. We're looking at going through profiling this audience, talking about some survey questions that the county's recently surveyed on, and moving forward with a discussion of growth trends from Chuck Stevenson. Fiscal resources, Bill Stout, the way we're going to try to keep moving along here pretty good today. Since our crowd's a little smaller than we thought, we may be able to get out of here earlier than we had originally planned when we go through our questions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over and have Pat Beck do a little introduction here. Oh, no, excuse me. I'm jumping ahead, Pat. Chuck Anders. I got my Chucks mixed up. Chuck Anders is going to come on now and talk to you about the profiling and the clicker. Chuck?
Good morning, everyone. What we're going to do initially as we go through this process, we're going to use a tool called, it's an interactive polling technology. And I see a lot of faces in the audience, and I know I've used this before. But what this does, it's an FM radio transmitter receiver, and it provides the opportunity for you to instantaneously express your opinion with regard to issues, and then we can consolidate those opinions and see the results immediately, and then talk about those results. So we want to use this, take advantage of this technology to get everyone's sense of the issues as we walk through this. And we're going to use it consistently in each of the four workshops that we have planned over the next month or so. And then we can look at the individual regional opinions, and we can also consolidate the data and look at the overall opinions. In addition to collecting the data, what this technology is very useful at is really focusing on critical issues so that we can talk about them. So we're not just collecting data. We also want to use this to talk about and focus the discussion. Before we begin, we'd like to collect some background information, find out basically who's here, and then you can have an idea of who's in the audience and who they kind of represent. And we can also use that information to look at the results by demographic category. So the first question, we need to do our high-tech projector switch. The first question is, where do you live? So if you take one of the clickers, and we call them clickers because they remind you of TV remote control, select the number that corresponds to the appropriate answer for you. Okay, now this is where we kind of register everybody's participation. So to make sure that your clicker got registered, press the same answer again. Okay, looks like we have 32 people participating. The next question is, do you live in an incorporated city or town or a rural area? Now, if you see your clicker number in that box down to below, the system's waiting for your answer. So number 46, put your answer in again. There you go. Where do you work? Number 22 and 100. How long have you lived in San Luis Obispo County? And what is your household income? Now, this technology, this process is anonymous, so people can feel free to answer the questions as they like. We do sort it by demographic category, but not by individual keypad or response. We really don't keep track of who has what keypad. Number 24. Do you own your own residence? This is the toughest question of them all. What is your age? And your ethnicity? And what stakeholder group best describes your participation in this meeting? Do you own your own residence? Almost 80% of the participants own their own residence. Guys outnumbered the ladies, almost 2-1. We have a pretty good distribution of age, but most of the folks here are between 40 and 65. Ethnicity is a good participation, it's at least representation. At least of every ethnicity group except American Indian, primarily Anglo and white. Stakeholder groups that are represented. Elected officials, let's see, we have 2 elected officials here, 3 participants from advisory committees, 11 folks that are represent government in some form or another, 1 person from financial and development community, 1 nonprofit, 7 students, and 7 folks are here representing themselves as private citizens. And about half of you participated in the 2050 workshops and half didn't. So that's just a good cross-section of who's here, and this will be useful information as we go through these workshops to see if there's any common themes with regard to opinions and perspectives by these demographic categories. Now, I think it was only just a few weeks ago the county had commissioned a survey, and in this countywide telephone survey of I believe it was approximately 400 participants throughout the county, they asked a series of questions relating to growth. And so what we would like to do here today is ask you all those same questions and see if the participants that are participating in these workshops, if their opinions correspond to the results of the countywide random survey. So in order to entice you to stick around to the end, what the planners of this conference have decided is that we're going to collect these data from you right now, and then we're going to show them to you at the end of the meeting and show you the comparison between the county survey and your opinions. And the reason we need to do that is because we need to take the data, put it into some different charts so that we can show you easy comparisons. So the first set of questions dealt with community issues. And community issues were traffic congestion, population growth, lack of a well-paying job, not enough housing priced for the average worker, too much development in rural areas, and declining quality of life. And they asked a simple question, which was, on a scale from 1 to 9, how would you rate the significance of this issue in your area? So if it's not a problem, you press a 1. If it's extremely serious, you press a 9. And if it's somewhere between on that range, you may say, well, it's a 7 or an 8 or a 2. So go ahead and express your opinion. And in this case, when that bar, you've got 20 seconds, and when that bar reaches 0, the system is going to move forward. So if you don't get your answer in, we won't get your opinion. So you beat the bar. Population growth, how would you rank that? How serious is this issue in your area? Number 24. Lack of a well-paying job. $114 and $135. Not enough housing, price for the average worker. And too much development in rural areas. And declining quality of life. Okay, now we're going to ask you all a question that we didn't ask in the survey. And that is another aspect. We're going to go through that list again and ask the question, how well are we addressing this issue today? So on the same scale from 1 to 9, if you think, boy, we're really addressing traffic congestion very well, you'd press a 9, or you say, well, I think it's more a 3. So on, in your opinion, how well are we addressing traffic development in rural areas? Declining quality of life. Okay. Now, in the survey, they also ask a series of questions. So we've got about 7 questions that we would like to pose to you. The first one, which of the following best reflects your opinion about how city governments and the county should cooperate on land use and growth issues? Do you think they should cooperate more closely than in the past, the same degree as in the past, work independently, or don't know, or you don't care? All right. Do you think that local government should match plans for new housing with plans for job growth in a specific area? Or should they plan for new housing even if not many jobs are planned in a specific area? Again, your choices are plan new housing to match plans for jobs, plan new housing even if not many jobs are planned, or don't know, don't care. Number 24. Next one. How small or large an area should planners be thinking about when making plans for housing and job growth? Do you think that local governments should plan to match growth in jobs and affordable housing? So across wider geographic areas, such as the North County, South County, Central Region, across the county as a whole, or don't know, don't care? Number 45. Do you think it's better to steer growth toward undeveloped rural areas, areas already developed communities, both, neither, or don't care? We have limited water supply in San Luis Obispo County and a growing need for affordable housing. Which of the following options would you be more willing to accept in addressing these two shortages? Would you choose to conserve water, pay for additional water, limit growth to match existing water supply, or no opinion? Should local government allow new cities to develop next to existing ones? Plan to retain open land between cities? Or don't know or don't care? Okay, a couple more questions. This was a pretty extensive survey. They asked the participants, which of these two items would you prefer? A single family detached home on a large parcel of land, which is not near park, shopping, school, or work, or a single family detached home on an average or small lot near park, shopping, schools, and work. So on this one, if you like the single family home on a large parcel, you'd press 1. If you liked average or small lot, you'd press 2. Near parks, shopping, and schools. Give everybody a little more time on this one. 46 and 60. Okay. And the similar question, that is, would you prefer a neighborhood that is a mix of single-family homes, apartments, and condo projects near parks, shopping, schools, and work, or a neighborhood of single-family only, which is not near parks, shopping, schools, or... Everybody grab a piece of paper and a pencil and identify A, B, C, D, or E. Which one is your number one priority? So write down that letter and that item. Which one is your number one priority? Yes? Which one would you like to see happen in your community? Personally? Where would you like to see the emphasis added? Which is your number one? Okay, write down that letter, because the letters will show up in the next one. Now, which is the last one? Actually, what I'd like you to do, I'm not explaining this as correctly as I like. I'd like you to write down the letters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on your paper. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Put you to work here. And the one that you think is the highest priority, write that letter next to the 5. Highest priority is a 5. Everybody listen up. Highest priority is not a 1. That's the lowest. The highest priority is a 5. The one you picked for the lowest priority, you write next to the 1. Now, the second highest priority, you put next to the 4. Which one would you select next to the second priority? Put that next to the 4. This is what people were asked to do during a telephone poll. The third highest priority you put next to the 3. Okay, and then whatever's left you put in the 2. So, question is, developing more transportation choices, the A. If you put the A next to the 5, you say that's the highest priority, you press a 5 on your keypad. If you put it as a 2, you'd press a 2. Twenty-two, 23, and 114. Ah, you got it in. Okay, the next one, creating more walkable, B, creating more walkable communities. How did you rank that? What number did you press that next to? Put that next to. $22, $135, and $114. All right. C, increasing affordable housing supply. How did you rate that? D, protecting the environment. Number 22. And E, developing communities with housing near jobs. Okay, and we will be back to you after we compile this information, and you'll be able to see your opinions compared to the opinions countywide. So this is really exciting because it gives us an opportunity to see if the participants in this workshop are, in their opinions or perspectives, represent the overall county perspective. Okay, with that, Pat?
Thank you. Now I'm introducing Chuck Stevenson. Chuck Stevenson is the planner responsible for heading up the county's general plan review. Recently took smart growth principles.
Challenges that we're facing, and it helps us to formulate solutions and strategies to try to deal with those. Some of the many challenges that we're facing ahead of us are massive population increases in California. Experts continue to tell us and predict that we'll be seeing significant growth in California over the next 20 years. Our challenge is providing affordable workforce housing and sustaining our economic development and maintaining our community livability in face of tremendous growth challenges. The state's housing crisis is affecting us. It's affecting our housing prices, mainly because of limited supply and high demand that we're seeing. The cost of our housing continues to soar. The state has estimated that we need approximately 200,000 new homes every year for the next 20 years just to keep up with our population growth. So how are we doing with that? Actually, between 1990 and the year 2000, the state only constructed roughly 140,000 dwellings per year, which means we had a significant deficit. And, of course, that is limiting supply and raising demand and thus raising prices. We expect explosive and unprecedented growth continuing in the state of California. This will have an unprecedented amount of housing needed. And as you can see on the graphic, we're surrounded. Fortunately for us, most of the growth is anticipated in Southern California. Probably 60% of that growth is estimated to occur there. The Central Valley, roughly 20% of that additional growth. The Bay Area, a lesser amount, and to us, less than that. However, those surrounding metropolitan areas are creating pressure for us. I'm showing you this graph just to illustrate an interesting contrast. We're showing several larger metropolitan counties and their growth rates compared with Monterey County at the top and San Luis Obispo County at the bottom. And these three larger metropolitan areas are experiencing significant growth rates. Ours is actually pretty good. We're in the little less than 2% annual growth rate. However, as we can just sense from our growth in our communities, we're facing growth pressures. And it's mainly because of our limited resources and limited ability to expand our infrastructure needs. So we are facing growth pressure. The most startling and compelling challenge I think that we face is the affordability index, as it's referred to. Only 10% of households in this county can currently afford to purchase a median-priced home. And recently released numbers on this in July are that the median-priced home is about $566,000, which is just amazing. And adding to the problem is the increased competition for housing throughout the county as retirees or other people interested in moving into the area come here with large amounts of equity and can afford to pay cash for many homes. It really forces that competition up. The result is that we really need a variety of housing product other than the conventional single-family home on a large lot. We need apartments, condominiums, infill housing, as well as senior housing. So how are we doing to help ourselves in this county? I put this on just to illustrate a little situation. The top number indicates the number of building permits that the County of San Luis Obispo issued in 2003 and 2004. These are building permits issued for all types of residential uses. Of those, only 60 were multifamily units. And we usually look at multifamily units as an indicator. Those are generally more affordable. They're on smaller areas of land, generally smaller buildings. And so it's a bit of a measuring stick on how we're doing. So about 5%.
Chuck, are those in the unincorporated area?
Yes. I'm going to get to you in just a second. last year we did a little better. Again, about 1,200 total units, and 85 were for multifamily units. I compared this with the city, and thanks, John, for the prompt. Just a glance at it. The city is doing significantly better, which is good news. In 2003-2004, 123 permits were issued for housing units, of which 10 were multifamily. Several school districts in the county have been experiencing significant enrollment declines over the last few years, and this is particularly troublesome when we look at elementary schools. And it's generally attributed to the cost of housing, and families simply can't afford the high price. These charts indicate school enrollment and really tell an interesting story. I don't know if you can read these very well, but these are from the top left, San Luis Obispo School District, Atascadero, Unified, Morro Bay, Napomo, and Paso Robles. The top line in each one of these charts tracks school enrollment for elementary schools, and that's what I'd just like to focus on. You'll notice that in San Luis Coastal Unified, Atascadero, and Morro Bay, pretty significant decline in elementary school enrollment. Napomo and Paso Robles kind of holding their own for now. Another trend where we're seeing and tracking is our transportation patterns. And what this graph is showing, this is a statewide population statistic that shows that our population it relates our population growth to the amount of vehicle miles traveled each year. And basically, this is saying to us that we're not only driving a lot more, but we're driving greater distances. On a national basis, we're driving ourselves crazy. We're driving, in the last 10 years, we've increased the number of miles we drive by 25%. The time we actually spend in traffic, again nationally, is a substantial increase, 236% since 1982. And money lost in time and fuel, and this is, I'm sure, way low by today's standard, in the year 2000 was $78 billion. So, this gentleman said, and I think we're maybe close to this point. People and nations do behave wisely once they've exhausted all their alternatives. So what can be done? And this is the positive part of the talk. I would suggest three key efforts that we can begin, and that is to develop regional strategies, alliances, and intergovernmental coordination. This means between the cities and the county, between the unincorporated communities that are led by advisory councils, by community service districts, as well as regional agencies such as the Water Quality Control Board, Fish and Game, and the like. We can also build a higher percentage of affordable workforce housing, and we can implement smart growth principles. What is smart growth? Smart growth meets the needs of current generations without compromising future generations' ability to meet their own needs. That is to think long-term in decision-making. Sonny Wright McPeak, who is currently the Secretary of Business, Transportation, and Housing Agency for the state of California, I think appropriately defined dumb growth. The heart of dumb growth is housing farther and farther from job centers, longer commutes, greater pollution and impacts on habitat, and chewing up farmland. So, several just brief slides. I'll go through these quickly. Smart growth development patterns reduce some of the leading causes of air and water pollution, and it places value on protecting the environment and human health. Smart growth works to protect the quality of life for families. And sprawl, which is what we're all concerned about, it creates traffic congestion, as does a poor jobs housing balance. The key here is that congestion is mostly a result of land use pattern, not a lack of road capacity. Over the past 40 or 50 years, we've forced the segregation of our homes, workplaces, shops, and schools. Without changing this pattern of development, no amount of widening will relieve road congestion. And lastly, smart growth allows farmers and communities to save ag lands. And planning using smart growth principles allows communities to save production ag lands by directing development into existing areas first. On June 7th, the County Board of Supervisors endorsed a set of guiding principles for smart growth. This was really a landmark decision and action by the Board of Supervisors, and it should have a positive effect on growth patterns for years to come. I won't go through each one of these, but I did want to highlight just a couple, two or three. The first one, strengthening regional cooperation, is really a focal point, and it's why it's number one. Directing development. Here we typically have a business that would perhaps be in a downtown and would operate during the day and would close, say, at 5 o'clock. Towns kind of roll up. No commerce occurs and no life occurs in these towns. However, by the introduction of mixed use with residential above, all of a sudden things change. And you can envision a more active downtown because people are living there. It's a 24-hour downtown, if you will. So how do we make smart growth happen? I would suggest several things. One, that we in all of our communities support well-designed developments, that we do as we're doing here today and in the next few workshops, conduct community visioning exercises, that we implement regional community and neighborhood planning, and that we build coalitions that include the entire community. And as we can see, the future of the county is a great place to live, depends on all of us working together. Regional strategies and our cooperation among jurisdictions can do a lot to reduce sprawl, traffic congestion, and improve our jobs, housing, and balance. However, the problems we've created can't be solved with the same thinking that created them. Clearly, we need to come up with fresh new approaches to solve our housing crisis. And it can start with you and workshops like this where your voice can be heard. Thank you.
Thanks, Chuck, for that encouraging look for the future. My name is David Church. I'm with the Local Agency Formation Commission, and we're going to be next talking about fiscal issues. Before we get going, I just wanted to mention people who came in late and you need to register your clicker. Chuck Anders is going to do that before we get started on the polling the next time. So if you came in a little late, didn't get your clicker thing registered, we're going to take care of you in that regard. We do have today with us Bill Statler, and we have Jim Grant, and they're going to come up right now and kind of join the panel up here. And we're going to be talking about fiscal issues. Now, some people might say that before 10 o'clock, nobody should ever have a seminar that discusses fiscal issues. Because you might think that it might be a little boring, a little dry, kind of talking about a lot of numbers. Well, I'm here to tell you that that's not the case at all. And in fact, fiscal issues are at the crux of our growth and development issues. And they are the foundation for how our communities develop. They help us identify areas of development, but also identify areas of retail and residential development. So there's all kinds of fiscal issues that are underlying and going into the growth and development question. How revenues are generated by local government is a key land use issue. And it's something that we're going to talk a little bit about today. We are really fortunate to have Bill Statler, and come on up, guys, and have a seat. We got chairs for you, finally. Bill Statler from the city of San Luis Obispo, and we have Jim Grant from the county of San Luis Obispo. So we have the city and the county ends of things represented. Now, we were generous, and we gave them each 10 minutes to explain the complex fiscal workings of the state and county and city. So they're going to be quick and on the mark. But I do want to tell you that these guys have got almost 40 years, and they don't look like it, but they've got almost over 40 years of fiscal financial experience in local government finances. And with that, I'm going to introduce, first up is going to be Bill Statler, and he's going to speak from the city perspective with regard to finances and fiscal issues.
I'm delighted to be with you here today to talk about one of my favorite topics. And I cheated and looked in the book, and it has one of the questions is, fiscal issues are a lot more exciting than I thought. My personal goal is to score at least a 4 on the Chuck Anders scale on that. I'm going to be talking about sort of the tough fiscal issues and the tough fiscal challenges that are ahead of the city. Kind of cover a little bit about where cities come from, the fiscal challenges facing us, the role of a possible revenue ballot measure in addressing those, and then touch briefly on the relationships between cities' fiscal situation and land use issues. Challenges facing the city are the same as they're facing the 400 other cities in the state of California. Significant challenges in continuing to provide essential services to the community, and this has largely been due to state takeaways. In the case of the city of San Luis Obispo, over the last 15 years, we have $22 million less for parks, streets, playgrounds, public safety than we would have had but for state takeaways. And what we're at right now is service charges for service, like development review applications, like parks and recreation. It's certainly an important part of the city's revenue pie, but it's only 14% of the total. Where, how do we spend those sales tax revenues? 90% of the money that we spend is for day-to-day delivery of services, arresting bad guys, putting out fires, mowing parks, paving streets. About 5% right now is for capital improvements, and virtually all of that is dedicated to the maintenance side, paving streets, replacing storm drains. The important thing I'd like to point out here is 3 years ago, if I was doing the same presentation, capital improvements would have been 20% of this pie. This has been an area that we've had to cut back on. This has been one of the key victims, if you will, in our budget reduction strategies. We know we're not investing the resources we should be in new facilities, let alone taking care of the ones we have. And when you look at those operating programs, 50% public safety. This is appropriate. I mean, protecting the public safety is one of the key things the city exists to do. But what this means is we have to reduce back our costs if we want to protect and insulate public safety from those costs. And that means everything else has to be cut twice as deeply in order to balance the budget if you're not going to touch public safety services. We face significant budget gaps for each of the last 3 years. 2003-04, we had a $7 million budget gap. Put that in perspective, that's almost 20% of our entire general fund. That was followed up the next year with a $1.5 million gap, almost solely due to additional state takeaways beyond those which we had planned. And then the last year, we faced a $2 million budget gap. Now, the only good news about this is we've gone from a $7 million gap to a $2 million gap. The bad one is we closed each of these gaps. The city does not have deficits. We may have gaps that we're anticipating before we go into the budget process, but by the time we're done, unlike the state and federal government, we make revenues and expenditures balance out. So the only good news about $2 million, of course, is that's less than $7 million. The bad news is I've already brought to bear $7 million worth of solutions. So the $2 million worth of solutions that are left are much more difficult to address than the first $7 million. We close these gaps largely through expenditure cuts. As we look at how we close those budget gaps cumulatively over the last 3 years, 70% of that has been through expenditure reductions, significant component from day-to-day services, but here's where that capital improvement piece has come into play. That's where we've made a lot of our reductions. New revenues have played a role, but again, only about 14% of the solution, using and drawing down on our reserves, almost 20% of how we've balanced the budget cumulatively over the last 3 years. If you look at how we've done that, this has been our emphasis. Everyone on the operating budget side has participated in our reductions. But the administrative program, city clerk, finance, and IT, much deeper reductions than police, fire, and public works. This is intentional. We want to protect our frontline services as much as possible, and the support services bear the brunt of those reductions. And when you look at our staffing reductions, again, finance and information technology, 14% reductions in our staffing, police, the lowest level of reductions in staffing. The only thing I can say about this for the future is I can't continue to reduce my staffing by 14% every year, because at some point, 14% of zero is zero. Where's the, I don't want to say low-hanging fruit, but what are the areas that have had the least reductions? Police, fire, public works. Those are the ones in the future, if we're not able to get additional funding, those are the ones that are going to have to be the most impacted. These are just some examples of the community impacts. I'm not going to read them to you. You can read them on the board, but the one I do want to focus on is reduction in neighborhood paving program. Under our pavement management plan, we should be doing paving in neighborhoods about once every 8 years. And in fact, our goal is to do everything else in that neighborhood we need to do. If there needs to be tree pruning, if there needs to be sidewalk repair, curb and gutter repair, storm drain repair, water and sewer lines, we want to do all of that and then go in and do the paving, because that sort of is like ready, aim, fire. That seems like the right progression. We've had to totally suspend that. We know under our pavement management plan to have decent streets, we should be spending about $3 million a year. And we're spending about $1 million a year today. This has been one of the principal tragedies, if you will, or one of the principal victims in our budget balancing. And the hard part of this is if I closed a fire station tomorrow, people would immediately see the impact of closing that fire station. If I spend less money on street maintenance next year, people are not going to immediately see that impact, but it is absolutely going to be there in the long run. Why are we facing these challenges? Fair question, couple of key ones. Again, major driver, state takeaways, $22 million over the last 15 years, $3 million each and every year. Insurance cost increases, those of you that are in the private sector, you've absolutely seen the same things, especially after 9/11. Significant increase in workers' comp, significant increase in insurance, significant increases in property insurance. Our problem is not that we haven't had growth in our revenues. We have, but it's been very tepid. For example, in the case of transmute oxy tax, it's our third largest revenue source, $4 million a year. Until 2004-05, it's essentially been flat for the last 3 years. Now, compared to other areas in the state, all in terms of stock market prices, direct impact on our retirement costs, we kind of had the perfect storm of 9/11, dot-com blowups, and the impact on the market of corporate thievery like Enron, like WorldCom. Higher costs in all of our other key areas, like utilities and fuel, most importantly, pavement. That's an area we've been cutting back on. But in light of higher costs, petrochemicals are a big part of asphalt costs. So with the limited dollars we have for paving are now even going to go fewer further because of that. And then reduced grant revenues. Just one small example, a couple years back, Prado Day Center, which is an important thing for us to be supporting for a homeless population, do that in cooperation with the county. But that used to be a grant-funded program. Now that's coming out of our general fund. Why not cut services even more? The short answer is, in everything we've done, whether it's professional public opinion surveys, whether it is what we've done through our community budget process or focus items, the overwhelming number of folks tell us they want us to continue to provide the same level of services or more. Just some quick examples at our community forum, overwhelmingly more of the same, almost no one wanted less. Public opinion survey, take a look at those columns in green, all in the 70s for these key services to do the same or more. And when you look at the we're spending too much, man, nobody thinks we're spending too much on these services. Rating of city services, very high. That probably explains a lot of why we're facing what we're facing. Long-term challenges. We want to be able to continue to do the services that people want, but we know that if we're going to continue to do those, we just don't have any choices. Why is this urgent? Significant increases in demands for service, we just don't have the resources to do that. We've been used millions of dollars from our reserves to fund essential services, and what you may not be able to tell from this picture, you may think that's water at the bottom of that storm drain. It's not. It's dirt. The bottom of that storm drain is completely deteriorated. State raids on city finances, and significant reductions in upkeep. Any measure we would present would have a number of fiscal provisions in it. One of the key ones would be some type of sunset provision. If we're going to ask people to trust us that we're going to spend their funds wisely, then there should be some ability at 5 years down the line, did we meet those obligations? So what are kind of the key funding priorities in the community? Maintaining city streets and infrastructure, traffic congestion, public safety services, protecting senior services. Still in the very early stages of planning for this, we do know this. We think that sales tax is the best source of funding for us. It's very broad-based, at least for San Luis Obispo. Only about half of that funding would come from people that live here. Our sales tax rate today is the lowest level in the state of California. And if we increased it by a half a cent, it would still be equal to or less than the rate paid by 85% of the rest of the state. Even at a higher rate, we would still be in the mainstream of what other folks are doing. Statewide, 26 cities have a measure of their own, and at this point, every city in the county is considering a very similar measure in November 2006. Touch very briefly, and then I'll do my 1 minute and get off, about the relationship between fiscal issues and land use. There's absolutely a relationship between the land uses you have and the physical shape you're going to be in. It doesn't have to be intrinsically true. I mean, I'll give you the short story now. Housing is a huge fiscal loser. That doesn't mean housing's bad. It just means that the way that finances are structured in the state of California, housing can never be a fiscal winner. It could be. You could certainly change the way that local government finance happens, and you can make incentives that housing is how you grow your city rich by developing more housing. That's not because housing has to intrinsically be a loser. It's just the structure that we have in the state of California. The other point I'd like to emphasize is that as you determine as you analyze fiscal relationships, it's absolutely best to focus at the general plan level rather than focus on case-by-case reviews. And the reason for that is once I've developed the model of what kind of revenues and costs are associated with residential, what's associated with retail, what's associated with hotels, the results are predictable. So, predictable results, housing, trust me on this, will always be a fiscal loser. Some types may be less of a fiscal user than others. There may be some things you can do from land use design to mitigate that, but housing will always be a loser. Office and industrial, probably about break even. Service costs, very low, but revenues from office and industrial, very low. Remember, a third of the city's finances come from retail sales. Not too much retail sales typically in a professional office building. Hotels, almost guaranteed to be a fiscal winner. Why? Relatively low service costs. The people that come visit don't actually live here. They don't need our schools. They don't need a lot of the services the city offers. But we have transfeed oxy tax, and that turns it into a fiscal winner. Retail, this is really important. It depends. If you know in your fiscal complement that you already have maximum penetration at certain, and with that at the appropriate time, I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Jim Grant, and I'm one of the deputy county administrators for the county and the budget director. And I can always count on Bill to pretty much cover everything that needs to be covered in the finance area. So my presentation is going to be fairly short, but I'm going to point out some very distinct differences between county finances and city finances, because they are distinct. And as we pull up the PowerPoint, we will begin in just a moment. Okay, move on. There we go. And I want to talk about county funding county services this morning, and I want to do an overview. And that overview right now is just going to talk about a little bit about a general information that we have, county structure, funding county services, where our revenues come from and where they go, fiscal challenges facing the county, and then we'll do questions from there. Just the general information, in 1850, San Luis Obispo County became one of the state's original 27 counties. There are now 58 of those counties. Our county contains 3,316 square miles, or over 2 million acres. And it's important to realize that, because it's a big county in terms of square miles. And it's a lot for the county to cover in terms of providing services in all the areas of the county, from all the way up to the border, Monterey County border, all the way down south and east. It's a very, very massive county. And 39% of that, almost 40%, are in agricultural preserves right now, which means as you go through that planning process, you have to realize that there's a lot of open space, there's a lot of ag that you have to deal with as you look to define that balance of where you're going to grow. One of the basic differences in county services is that the county is a political subdivision of the state. In other words, we're an arm of the state. We're part of the state, and the state is able to mandate what services counties actually provide in many areas. And so it's a big distinction, because what the state can do is say, you need to provide services in the health, the mental health, the social services area, and we will pay for it generally. But that doesn't always happen. The state then comes back and says, well, we want you to provide all of these services, but, you know, we really can't afford to send you all the money to provide these services. So, county, can you absorb a lot of that as you go through your budgeting process, which causes a problem for us, because now we're absorbing things that we weren't that weren't intended to be absorbed, and the state's really obligated to provide that. But because we're an arm of the state can mandate that. And so we do a number of things. We provide services to the unincorporated area, we provide countywide services, which I'll get into in just a moment, and we provide the state-mandated services. So the local services are similar to a city, only on a much grander scale, and we provide roads and public works, law enforcement, fire protection for the unincorporated area, not the city areas, but the unincorporated area, which again is very spread out. And land use planning. Those are the local things that we do, and we use the local tax dollars to provide those, and I'll talk about that in a minute. We also provide countywide services that includes all the cities and the special districts in the county, and you can see the list is long. So social services, mental health, veterans, libraries, regional parks, airports, juvenile hall, district attorney, child support, probation, ag, clerk, assessor, the list goes on. It's rather lengthy of all the things that the county has to provide that is on a regional basis that includes everyone. So where do our revenues come from? Well, most of our revenues, the bulk of them, come from state and federal dollars. And the next largest chunk of revenue comes from local property taxes. So, and then from there it goes on, and you can see it's a huge decline from there in terms of where else we get our money. Charges for services, other financing sources, other revenue. Not much. So the bulk of the revenue comes from state and federal areas. Well, where do we spend that money? Well, again, because we get the money from the state, the bulk of the money goes to health and human services. And so we do spend our money on that, although the county has to kick in a portion of that, of our local revenue, to do that, which then stretches our budget because there's not enough for the roads and the fire and the police protection. Oops, let me go back one.
Hang on.
Try the mic.
There we go. Got it. So again, just looking at it a different way, Health and Human Services is about 38% of our budget. Or like any other county throughout California, is that because of the state takeaways that Bill mentioned, we have lost about $262 million over the last 15 years. And every year, we're losing about $31 million, that's about 10% of our budget, to that state takeaway. That's huge money for us, and that also made us cut back for the last 3 years. We've had to cut dramatically in terms of our service level as well. So because of this takeaway, everyone's been struggling. Additionally, the state mandates are there, too. The state's had their fiscal problems, and because they've been taking money away from us to help support the state areas, the state's still been cutting back, and they've been giving counties more mandates to cover. So we have a double whammy where we're not getting the money we need, and the state's laying more work on us, essentially, to cover with our local dollars. We have increased the cost of doing business as well. Just like everybody, we have costs for providing salaries and workers' compensation and liability. All of those things are up, and we need to deal with that. And we have minimal discretionary revenue that we can use to fund those services with. So all in all, what's important to think about is that as we go through this process, that there's only so much money that's in the coffers to plan and to prepare for the future of what we want to do. Where do we want to put our money? Do we want to put it in police and fire and local services? Typically, yes, that's where we want to put it. So we have to make some hard priority decisions in terms of the long-range planning. How do we want to do that? Where do we want to put our money? And so that's going to be a challenge for this group. As you look at the future of planning, how do we want to look, but how are we going to pay for it to be able to afford to do it? So one of the things, I just attended a county administrator's meeting last week, and this growth issue is probably the biggest obstacle and the biggest challenge in all the 58 counties. Almost every county administrator said growth is the biggest challenge that we have right now. Along with the fiscal issues, growth is our biggest challenge over the years. Updating the general plans is a huge deal right now in all the counties. So we are not alone in this. Everybody's experiencing this. And as one of the people said as we left, he said Californians really hate two things. They hate sprawl and they hate density. So the challenge is yours to deal with it. Thank you very much.
I think that pretty well summarizes it right there. That is the challenge for the future. Let's hear it again for our fiscal guys, Bill and Jim. What we're going to do next is we're going to have Chuck Anders take you through a series of questions regarding the fiscal issues, and he's going to poll you. Before he does that, he's going to register a couple of new folks, I think. Is that right, Chuck?
That's right. Anyone who came in, first of all, those of you who answered the previous poll, stay with the same clicker number, so the demographics remain consistent. And for those of you who just came in, we'll get your clickers registered as we go through this process. We've got seven simple questions that the fiscal folks would like to ask you with regard to your opinion. So the first question is, fiscal issues are far more exciting than I ever imagined. And you can express your opinion about whether you agree or disagree with that. You never know. Okay, so if everyone would go ahead and respond to this question. And the new folks that came in, please go ahead, answer the question, pick a clicker. And since we are making sure that everybody gets registered again, so go ahead and push your answer in one more time. Okay. Next question. Local agencies are adequately funded and need to live within their fiscal constraints.
beat the bar. A local sales tax increase would be a good way to fund local services and infrastructure projects. How important are the level of municipal services like police, fire, and street maintenance and parks in determining quality of life? Well, you know, the panel did a good job in encouraging everyone. Local agencies are adequately funded and need to live within their fiscal constraints. The majority of you disagree or strongly disagree. 85% agree or strongly disagree. Anyone want to comment on that? Why does this group feel that strongly? Anyone have any comment? Any thoughts? Okay, let's press on. A local sales tax increase would be a good way to fund services and infrastructure projects. And you have almost 90% agree with that. A sales tax would be a good way to go. Comment?
My comment was actually on the previous question, but
okay.
I think that the people in the room are primarily agency people. Probably 90% of the people in the room are within the agency, so it's somewhat...
It's a good observation. Again, it'll be interesting to see how this group's opinions compare with countywide results. Yes?
This is also to the previous question. Am I on?
Speaking into the mic a little.
When we see library services closing and in light of recent national tragedies, lack of attention to flood control and some of our basic preventive services, that is distressing. And so I just live within your means as the means are defined.
Okay. Very good. Next question. A local sales tax increase would be a good way to go. Again, almost 90% support that. How important are the level of municipal services like police, fire, street maintenance, and parks in determining quality of life? Again, almost 70-80% feel that those services are extremely important to our concept of quality of life. Why is that? Why might that be? Why is that more important than is it important to support those activities? Any thoughts? Yes. Okay. If people didn't hear, if that mic wasn't turned on or working, it's important to live in a safe place, and that's a critical aspect to how quality of life is evaluated in this community, especially probably compared to contrasting it to larger communities. Yes?
Is this
on? No, it's not. I don't think so. Okay. So the flip side of that is what the city hears is those types of too many potholes and services are inadequate. Yes, back here.
No, I think the quality of services provided sort of reflect a pride of community attitude. And so if the government, which is sort of our collective will to action, is providing good services and keeping the community in good shape, I think it reflects on the citizenry. You go back to the way that New York City has changed, where services were provided to fix small things, broken windows, graffiti, taking care of it. That motivated an entire change in the attitude of what it was like to live. So I think it speaks very much to livability right there.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Yes, one more comment, and then we'll move on. I'm going to make sure that we stay on time, too. So I want to, if I press us too much, please let me know.
My comment is regarding the changing demographics in the county in terms of safety. We're noticing that there are fewer school children. There are more of us gray-haired folks. And safety and services for that aging population are very important. And I know we have a lot of seniors. I mean, I've grown old here, but there are a number of seniors coming into the area.
Okay, thank you very much. Next question. I would be willing to have a decrease in service levels rather than an increase in tax to fund services at their current levels. 75% or more said no, I would not be willing. Yes.
I have an answer, not an answer, not a solution answer, but a comment on all of the questions you've asked so far. As a former elected official and being advisory to a number of government agencies in the past 20 years, it's always the same thing, which leads to the only answer. Excuse me. Citizens, constituents, the people we're looking after as elected officials want all the good stuff, but they don't want it next door and they don't want to pay for it. Our biggest job is to educate the public. And we go and say, would you be willing to pay more tax? We have to be very careful about how we put it to them and how much information we give them. They need to know more. Most people don't know in the city of San Luis Obispo what Bill just told us about the financial picture. I'm the one that sent the thing about the facts, Bill. I don't know if you knew that. And that was a good example. I got a survey from the chief of police and chief of fire, and it said, send your answer by faxing it to such and such a number. And I wrote back an email, which was passed on to Bill, that said, I can't fax. I don't have any facilities for faxing. And how many people in the city can't do that? Those kinds of things must be remembered by staff when these things go out so the people can have their say, can answer, can give an opinion. And I just think that's our biggest basic problem.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Yes, one more comment and we'll go on.
Yeah, we have to keep it moving here, Chuck.
Yep, we're running a little late.
I would just say to Mayor Dave and to you, Bill, that I strongly support your tax increase. And I think if you're going to go through all the trouble of increasing taxes, don't just go for a half cent. Go for maybe a little bit more because you're going to spend a lot of dollars. I think that it's a very nice place to live. It's expensive to live here. Houses are expensive. People have money who live here for the most part. That little tiny bit isn't going to make that much difference on sales tax alone.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next question. How important should fiscal impacts be in analyzing land use? Again, there's a pretty strong opinion that it should be. It's extremely important or it's considered important. California should consider a comprehensive revision to the way taxes are allocated to local agencies. 90% agree or strongly agree. Okay. Well, there's one other comment over here before we close this topic.
It's okay. You know, I'm one of the folks who live in South County and work in San Luis. And while all you folks I recognize you got pothole, police issues, the biggest problem if you live in the South County and work in San Luis Obispo is you're in the majority of the people who are on the freeway getting stuck in traffic every day. And that's the job housing imbalance, and that's as big of an issue for the rest of the county as getting your streets paved are for everyone else.
Okay. Thank you very much. David?
Are we on to the next?
I think we're from a timing standpoint.
Okay.
We can move on to the next item.
I think we have Dana Lilly coming up, and he's going to introduce John Dunn for the economic issue.
Our next speaker, John Dunn, he's very familiar with the issues we've just been discussing, since in many of his past experiences he had to deal with that issue. Most recently, he acted as city manager in Morro Bay, and for many years was city manager for the city of San Luis Obispo. He's also assisted the Housing Trust Fund as they got started, so he's aware of a lot of these issues. And if you welcome John, he'll get up here and speak.
Thank you. Good morning. I get the dubious distinction of talking about economics, the dismal science. I'll quickly say, to paraphrase a former public official, I am not an economist. The last panel had 40 years of experience between them. This panel has over 40 years within it. And gosh, I admire you young guys that like to deal with county and city finance. Let's talk about the economy of our county. And first of all, as you drive around and look around and read the papers, you see that we have a darn good economy in most respects. We obviously have a county economy that's strong enough to support a quarter of a million people. We fairly consistently have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the state of California. We're obviously strong in agriculture, in tourism, retail, utilities, government, and education. And out of the seven cities, at least four of them, depending on your way you look at them, have very strong and vital downtowns, which is certainly not something that all cities in our state or country have. Retail growth has been very strong in various parts of the county over the last several years. Viticulture, our wine industry, represents both a strength in the agricultural realm and in the high-end tourism realm. And so we have a darn good and a darn strong economy, I think an economy that all of us can be justifiably proud of. So, what's wrong with this picture? Well, we don't really know because the facts in all cases aren't available, but I'm going to talk for a moment about three charts that I looked at great length in the late summer while I was still with EVC. By the way, that was a great experience for me to serve as the interim director. John Scholes out here, who is the mayor of Grover Beach, is also the chairman of the EVC, and I want to thank John and everyone else for this opportunity because it forced me to learn a lot more about our economy than I ever knew before. But the total number of jobs in our county is over 100,000, roughly 103,000 jobs. There's a long chart put out by EDD with probably hundreds of figures on it, and I'm only going to pick on two of those figures right now. The goods-producing jobs, production jobs, about 14,200. It's a lot of jobs. Service-providing jobs, 85,000. Almost a 6-to-1 ratio. So we are overwhelmingly a service economy. To kind of borrow a line from Bill, that isn't necessarily bad, because indeed that's the way the United States of America and the state of California is going. There are certain aspects of it that can be worrisome, and that is we're producing a large number of service jobs at kind of the lower end of the economic spectrum. Their hourly rates, they have no fringe benefits, and certainly at $7 an hour, $10 an hour, it doesn't allow people to buy into the good aspects of the county, such as homeownership being one of them. So, where are these jobs? Retail trade, 13,500. Education and health services, 10,700, and with a couple of exceptions, I'm only mentioning categories, over 10,000 jobs. We're talking about the biggies in our county. Leisure and hospitality, the famous tourist industry, 15,700, almost 16,000 jobs. Just the food and drink portion of that, over 10,000 jobs, 10,300. Government, 20,000, which can be further broken down into state government, about 8,800, and local government, 10,700 jobs. Now, where does industry or manufacturing fit into this? 6,500 jobs. And so manufacturing is only half or less of some of these other categories. So the essence of this chart is that we are a service economy, And we are increasingly a service economy, and we have to look at the implications of that. Another chart talks about the 25 largest employers within the county. Higher education at 2 employers. I'm only talking about the 25 largest employers. State government, 4 employers. Private sector business, 5 employers. Primary and secondary education, 4 employers. Local government, 2 employers. Hospitals, private health care, 5 employers. In the collective, those 25 employers account for almost 25,000 jobs. But you'll notice that there, in this list, there were 13 government agencies, there were 2 nonprofits, and there are 5 private sector firms. And so another moral, another idiosyncrasy of this county is that we have a large private sector. Indeed, it provides the majority of the jobs, but we don't have a private sector, unlike in other counties, that has large employers. Our large employers in this county are overwhelmingly government and education and medical health. Okay, a third chart. This was a toughie. I heard about it, and I finally obtained a copy. Unfortunately, it was 26 pages long, and it was 426 occupations listed. What it lists is EDD's best guesstimate, and this was done a few years ago, of the number of jobs to be created in this county. And it was for the years, I think it was 2003 to 2007. And so to some degree, it's out of date, but it still shows the trends. Now, I only selected jobs that didn't have 1 or 2 or 10 or 20 projected for the next for this 5-year period. I only selected those jobs that had 125 people or higher. Those jobs are in education, training, and library, healthcare practitioner and technical, food preparation and service related, over 200, again, our tourist industry, building and grounds, cleaning and maintenance, sales and related, the number one, which is 310 jobs. Retail salespersons. Office and administrative support, the second highest category, at 242 jobs. Construction and extraction. I've mentioned 8 categories. These are the growth areas in our county, over the area just behind us and the area just ahead of us. And you'll notice, again, the same thing. Overwhelmingly, service jobs, overwhelmingly lower paid, and the total job spectrum, overwhelmingly lower educational requirements. So these are just 3 charts, and 3 charts do not a county economy make. I'm just trying to point out some trends and some things that we have to be aware of and careful of. So, why should we have some concerns? As was pointed out by Dr. Robert Fountain at the Paso Robles Economic Forum, our educational attainment level in this county, believe it or not, despite Cal Poly, despite Cuesta College, despite others, is below the state average and is below the national average. And as many of you know, our national average is well below those of many other countries. So he spoke to, he wasn't exactly the most popular speaker when he mentioned this, but he spoke to the dumbing down of our economy. And frankly, I didn't really believe him, and so I went and consulted some graphs and charts, and he's absolutely right. There is a major educational deficiency in this county, and it counts when you're trying to recruit and select for certain types of jobs. You simply can't find the people in this county who are qualified, and then guess what? You advertise in the San Francisco Bay Area and the Los Angeles area, you attract some very good applicants. One or two of them will say yes, and guess what? 3 days later, they call and they say their wife was out home shopping. We can't afford to live in this area, so therefore, I'm turning the job down. As I've stated, we are heavy in service jobs. We're light in production jobs. We're light in higher-paying jobs. Obviously, for the greatest economic strength and vitality and diversity, we need more higher-paying jobs in order, again, that the people can buy into the high cost in this county, indeed in any coastal county in California. As has been mentioned, only 1 in 10 people in our county can afford the price of a median price home. Another one, which is the invisible problem within our county, because you almost hear no one speak to it, and the figures are scant, but the poverty rates in this county are relatively high. One city in this county has over a 10% poverty rate. Four other cities have over a 5% poverty rate. Some of the unincorporated areas within the county have even higher rates. Increasingly, our county could consist of the working poor, people who have jobs but who can't truly support themselves. The hourly rate job with no health insurance benefit doesn't quite pay the pass bill, the gas bill, the rent. It absolutely doesn't allow them to even consider buying a house in our area. So we risk losing our working people, our middle class, to other areas that have jobs with better pay, more affordable housing, and good schools. And why are those areas like the Central Valley and the Riverside areas growing so fast? Because this is the perception, is that there's a place where a family can go and realistically live, whereas coastal communities have kind of priced themselves out of that market. We risk not having enough higher-paying jobs to keep people here, and again, if we have to attract people from the outside, an increasing danger that they will turn us down. We risk not having enough economic diversity to maintain a strong economy. So I've listed some thoughts and some concerns. None of them are gospel, and none of them are irreversible. But, so you say, what do we do now? I have a very simple solution, which we've been discussing at the EVC. It is obviously not a job for one agency or one person. It's a job that all of us have to engage in together. We have to take a realistic and honest look at our economy. We have to accumulate data about our economy. We project that data into the trends of where our county is realistically going in the 5 or 10 years coming up. We ask ourselves a very basic question. Is this where we want to end up? Is this the direction where we want to go? If the answer is, as I suspect it would be, no, this is entirely a pretty picture, then we ask ourselves, what are some alternative scenarios? What are other directions that we could be heading for? What do you have to do to get there? We select one or a combination of those scenarios, and we ask ourselves those questions. What do we have to do to get there? In asking ourselves the question, we are engaging in economic planning for this county. Why is that important? Well, obviously, I think it's important on its face that this is one of those things that you should be doing. It's also important because this county has no economic plan. Now, I've argued with people on that, and people will pull out this document and this report and that report, and they'll say, this is an economic plan. And I'll say, no, it isn't an economic plan. It's an economic report that someone did. It's darn good work. And we have some wonderful work being done in our county, not least of which is by UCSB Economic Forecast Project. But that's basically reporting on what is happening, and it gives kind of a tepid projection of what may be happening in the next 2 or 3, 4 years. It does not really say this is the kind of county economy that we desire to have, and this is what we're going to do to get there. That's real economic planning. So the question that we as a county have to ask, you know, do we have the guts, the political will, to look at our county realistically and to project present trends to probably conclude that this isn't a good place that we may be going. In other words, it's not producing a truly sustainable economy over the long period. And then the courage to change our direction, to add some new elements to that plan, some creative elements, and to at least partially to start going in a different direction. That's going to be the test before us in the next several years, and certainly EVC, working with a lot of others, wants to be involved in the forefront of this careful reexamination of our county economy. Beyond that, I'll stop and just open it up to questions. And if not, I'll sit down gracefully.
Okay, we have some economic vitality questions to ask you. And we need to do our high-tech switch. And the first question is, San Luis Obispo County has a diverse economy that is sustainable over the long term. Do you agree or disagree? To what extent? Number 84. Next question. Are we headed for an economy in which the working poor will primarily serve the wealthy? SLO County's economy needs to grow more private sector opportunities that provide higher salaries and better benefits. We should be more concerned about the national economy and its impact on San Luis Obispo County. I am willing to accept moderate impacts to the quality of life for a project or business proposal that significantly improves the local economy of the county. Do you agree or disagree? I would not support any business proposal or project if it does not adequately mitigate environmental impacts, regardless of the economic benefits. And we need to make it easier for business with good projects that are not do not impact sensitive habitats or viewsheds, is transit friendly, results in shorter. I'll stop this. You want to read all of that? In shorter commutes, improves the jobs of housing imbalance, located near urban services, to set up shop in our county. Okay, let's quickly look at the results. Do you believe that the county has a diverse economy that is sustainable over the long term? We have almost 70% say disagree or strongly disagree that this economy is not sustainable over the long term. Any comments or thoughts? Why might that be? Just what we heard? Okay. We are headed for an economy in which the working poor will primarily serve the wealthy. 100% of you agree or strongly agree. What does that mean for us? Nothing good? Any comments? What does that mean for this community?
I don't think it means anything. By definition, working poor or people who are in the service economies work to serve those with whom have the money that want the services.
Okay, so from your perspective, it doesn't really mean anything. It's just the way it is. Yes.
I think there are two trends here. One is a belief that this is probably where the nation as a whole is headed, and to a certain degree, San Luis Obispo County may not be that unique. But we also have some unique things here. One of the reasons why I think we have a significant housing affordability problem is the price of housing is disconnected from the labor market. A huge part of what's driving the prices are people retiring and relocating from other areas who aren't dependent upon this economy. So you take what I think are some national trends, and then you magnify those with unique situations in San Luis Obispo County where there's just a basic disconnect between what people earn and the demand for housing, because so much of the demand for housing has absolutely nothing to do with the local labor market.
Chuck, here we go, Chuck.
Who's next? Okay. My turn? Okay.
Is there any way to look at other economies like Carmel or Santa Barbara, Montecito? Those people have already gone through what we're going through. Is there any way we can follow their advice, let's say, because they're probably 5 or 10 years ahead of us?
Okay, so as we go through this process, look to lessons learned in other communities that have preceded this process.
I think another impact out of this is that it'll put greater demand on the services, especially by the county, human services, social services, and that sort of thing.
I think one of the lessons we can learn from Monterey County and the Monterey Peninsula is that it's going to lead to a lot more traffic congestion problems, because if there are going to be working poor in the county, they're going to be living in the most affordable areas. It's going to lead to congestion. It's going to lead to overcrowding of housing units, because you're going to be putting, you know, as many people as it takes with low incomes to afford the high cost of housing locally. I think it's going to lead to social strife, as you have haves and have-nots, and it's going to create those kinds of social problems. And along with the overcrowding in certain housing units, you have neighborhood problems, parking problems, infrastructure problems that are created by having more people in those places than they're meant to support. So it's going to create a variety of different problems.
We've got time for one more comment here. Two more. We'll go for John.
If I might, I think the term working poor should be an anachronism, in my view. If somebody works, they shouldn't be poor. If somebody works, they should earn a living wage. And I believe in this county, that's an issue that we ought to address. Without even going into the whole question of class and the increasing gap between the wealthy and the poor in this country, we can do something locally, it seems to me, to improve wages and working conditions of our workers, our labor force.
Okay.
We ought to do that locally.
Okay. I was wondering if one of the young folks here might have a observation.
I do. I think that it's not taken into consideration that most of the working force is students. And the reason that I think this community has gotten away with paying such low wages is they think that we don't need adequate, like, supplementation because we rent or our parents support us, but then in turn we're not represented at all. I haven't heard at all once students mentioned in this, and I think this community doesn't take into consideration that a huge reason the economy works here is that we do go to restaurants, we pay for a lot of the services that are here, and that we fund a lot of what goes on in this community, but we are considered second-class citizens, we cause too much problems, we are loud, and that the benefits of us being here in this economy isn't taken into consideration. I think that students should be incorporated more in this, and I think that their opinions and their needs should be really considered when talking about things like this, and not just the retirement community or, you know, government agencies. And I think that's unfortunate that such a large population isn't represented at all.
Thank you. One more comment. Yes.
Building. Okay. Building on everything that's been said, a large component of our population are retirees. A problem is that service people don't have housing. A planning solution might be to have an overlay district for affordable housing. We look at more complicated solutions to house people, but there is a planning solution that hasn't been implemented.
Okay, thank you. Let's look at the results of the rest of the questions real quickly. Slow counties of economy needs to grow more private sector opportunities that provide higher salary, better benefits. So strong support for that. We should be more concerned about the national economy and its impact on San Luis Obispo County. Sort of a 50-50 perspective. I'm willing to accept moderate impacts on my quality of life to support business proposals that significantly improve local economy. Again, you've got about 60% that agree and 40% that disagree. Now, I would not support any business proposal or project if it doesn't adequately mitigate environmental impacts. And almost 80% agree with that statement. We need to make it easier for business with good projects to set up shop in our county. And I think that 100% agree with that observation. Any final comments before we move on to the next topic? Yes.
There you go.
We're going towards a sort of very strong bimodal distribution of income, and that we're talking about the very low paid workers in terms of the $8 to $10 an hour jobs, and what it would take to afford entry into our housing market, which is probably something around $60 to $80 an hour. But where I think our government workers, our teachers, the people who can't get jobs, those who would apply from the Bay Area and Southern California, if we had affordable housing, these are the people, the middle, the gap between the $10 an hour jobs and the $80 an hour jobs. This is what we see really shrinking.
Okay. Thank you very much. We need to move on to our next topic, which is housing. And Dana? Okay.
I have to stand up so you can see me. Actually, four of us worked on the questions on housing. One of them was George Moylan. As you know, George is the executive director of the Housing Authority for the city of San Luis Obispo for almost 20 years. He died a couple of weeks ago. George was a good friend and colleague. He was a man of incredible humor and wit, decent, dignified, compassionate, and courageous. He believed that housing, affordable housing, was a right everyone shared. He did not think housing was a commodity or an investment. And he was never afraid to tell anyone and everyone exactly what he was thinking and exactly what was wrong with your thinking. So I'd ask you for a brief silence in memory of a good friend of housing and the community. I'm also going to introduce Dana Lilly. Dana also brings passion and intelligence to his job and the issue. He worked in the private sector for a nonprofit housing provider for 3 years, and for the last 20 years he's worked for the county government in planning. He's currently, from my perspective, heading up the housing element update. I think Dana's got a really tough job. He serves three taskmasters, elected officials who are always thinking about getting reelected, a public that's chaotic and often conflicted about what's in its own best interest, and a private sector that wonders how government can be so clueless and continue to function. Personally, what I respect most about Dana is I know that even when he disagrees with me, he listens, he understands, and he always looks for the best solution. Dana Lilly.
Thanks, Jerry. That's the best introduction I've ever had. Wow. The story I'm going to tell you is pretty brief, and it's kind of a very similar to what you've been hearing already today, a lot of the repeated themes. There's really some trends we're seeing, there's some consequences of those trends, and there's some actions, and probably no action is just as powerful as an action in this case. Go ahead. Is there a clicker up here for me?
Great.
That wasn't it. Upper left. Okay. I'm a planner. We love numbers. And I thought you might like to see some recent numbers, so here they are. If you look at different sources, you'll get different quotations for what the median income is in the county. And the bottom line is it's well over $500,000 and going up. And here's some that show your communities and how much it's changed from last year. But you've been reading about this in the paper a lot anyway, so we'll move on. The 2005 economic outlook forecasts that that median price is going to go up to over $684,000 in just 4 years from now. And that might be low given the fact that their estimate for 2005 was low. Now, there are some consequences. As you've heard, only 10%, this is a statistic, so take it for what it's worth, only 10% of the households in the county can now afford that median priced home. I know for myself and many of the people I talk to, I couldn't afford the house I own now if I had to try to buy it now. I see some heads nodding already, so that's probably pretty true. You've already heard businesses are leaving, businesses are closing. We've all read those articles in the paper. Some of those were businesses with some really good paying jobs. That's not a good trend. We've also heard the schools are closing. There's been quite a few schools closing, and it's pretty easy to see why. Families with children really can't afford to live in those school districts. That's probably going to continue. And it is true that traffic congestion in the county is increasing faster than population is growing. Yeah, some of that is passed through traffic from other regions, but a whole lot of it is because more of us are commuting farther and farther to work, to shopping, to recreation, to take our kids to soccer, and many of our other necessary trips, and that's going to continue to grow. Something you don't perhaps hear a whole lot, but is happening and has kind of an unquantified cost to us all, is that many families are under stress. They're spending so much of their money and their time commuting and paying for their high housing costs. They have less time for their families. They have less money to spend on necessities for themselves, health care, proper nutrition, education for their children, that they're under stress. And many dysfunctions can result, and sometimes we pay for those in a lot of different ways. Another thing sometimes we're not aware of is that these market forces are causing pockets of poverty to grow, and they have social costs as well. Just this past Wednesday, I was reading an article that you probably saw that now Fresno has the dubious distinction of having the highest concentration of poverty neighborhoods in the country. Now, this is in a recent study by the Brookings Institute that also talks about the poverty that was revealed when Hurricane Katrina came by. And there are a number of other areas. Well, inadvertently, our market and our choices are contributing to this poverty concentration happening in Fresno. It's not far from us. The people who can't afford to live here, who maybe were born here, who are in poverty, some of them are going there. If you get a big enough concentration of poverty, people can't get themselves out of those economic doldrums. The good schools aren't nearby. They have to commute further and further to work. So there's a lot of cost that we all pay nationally as taxpayers, in addition to it just being the wrong thing. You hear a lot of doom and gloom today, I guess. What should we do about it? You know, one of the actions, as I mentioned, is just we don't have to do anything. You know, you don't have to have your government interfere with the market. That's an option. And we can watch as our area does become more like Carmel and Santa, you know, the south coast of Santa Barbara County and some other areas. And we have asked some of them about their experiences and what we should do. And they say, well, if you haven't gone as far as we have yet, if there's something you can do to not go as far as we are in the housing unaffordability scene, you should do it. Some of the things you've heard already, we can try to do our best to promote higher densities, mixed use development. We can subsidize affordable housing, and when I say subsidize, I mean both from the public sector and the private sector. We do need to designate where housing can get built. And you've heard a number of people say one of our biggest challenges is growth, and I would submit it's not whether or not to grow as much as how are we going to grow. We've seen that there's a lot of pressure for people to come here, and we really ought to figure out where are they going to live. And some of it is to intensify our urban cores, unincorporated as well as cities, and some of it is we're going to have to designate some land that's not currently developed for housing. Smart growth, we really need to pay attention to, because if we grow, and we probably will grow, and we don't do it in a smart manner, there are lots and lots of other impacts that we've seen in some areas. Sprawl is a nasty word, but it happens. That's really it for me. I think I'm hoping we're getting closer to being on track, and I think we have a few questions, and if you have questions for me as well. Do we have a microphone?
Okay, we've got four quick questions. And the first one is, would you support more housing on vacant or undeveloped lots within your urban community if it allowed more rural open space and farmland to be preserved elsewhere? Would you accept and publicly support a well-designed higher-density development next door if it helped provide affordable housing for your children, fellow workers, friends, and employees? That's the NIMBY question, I think, isn't it? Since state and federal subsidies are no longer enough to make affordable housing financially feasible, should new development, existing homeowners, or both contribute to funding the remaining subsidy? And would you prefer to live near your workplace, shopping, schools, and parks if it meant living in a neighborhood that mixed single-family house homes, condominiums, and apartments? Or would you prefer commute to work, shopping, schools, parks if it meant living in a neighborhood of single-family homes? So which one would you prefer? Okay. Support for more housing on vacant or undeveloped lots within your urban community. 90% yes. Would you accept and publicly support a well-designed higher density development next door if it helped provide affordable housing? 90%. Since state and federal subsidies no longer support enough to make housing, would you support contribution to a subsidy? 75% here said yes. And would you prefer to live near your workplace, shopping, schools, and parks if it meant living in a neighborhood of mixed single-family homes? 90% yes. What is this telling us? Any comments?
No NIMBYs in this audience.
No NIMBYs in this audience, at least publicly? Pardon? Comment over here.
Questions don't allow what really is reality.
Oh, go ahead and talk.
My other question was of Dana in regard to SB 1818, which I understand is supposed to allow more affordable housing or developers to have perks for providing affordable housing within their developments. I'd like some discussion on that.
Some discussion on that might take quite a while, but SB 1818 completely changed how affordable housing density bonuses work with local government. It's much more generous to developers. We at the county are hearing a lot more applicants ask for incentives and possibly some density. But it remains to be seen yet if that will result in a lot more affordable housing. That's the answer.
There's a comment over here.
Yes, I just had a question about how we assign this new housing to those in need in our county. It's my impression that there's sort of an insatiable demand from outside to scoop up this housing. And I also understand that the city of Carmel is now over 50% second residences.
Okay. How is the housing assigned? Anyone want to comment on that?
Well, really just two observations. And the first one is, in a market-based economy, I think it's an iron law. I think even Jerry Bunin would agree with me on this. Desirable things are, by definition, more expensive than less desirable things. And here's the conundrum. I only know of one market-based way to become more affordable, and that's to become less desirable, which is probably a stated goal of very few communities. But I think it's a fact. The other one's a little definitional. I know we talk about only 1 in 10 can afford to live here, can afford to buy their homes. But, you know, that's a statistical approach to it. I would say, by definition, a very high percentage of people can afford to live here or they wouldn't be here. Secondly, if the definition of affordability is your income relative to the housing market, that probably means Beverly Hills is one of the most affordable places on earth. So some of it's definitional.
And your comments. Comment back here.
No, Bill, you do not have to become more undesirable. You can create a different mix in the market by supporting density and allowing for affordability by design. Everyone in this room would pay a lot less for a 1,300-square-foot home than they will for a 2,500-square-foot home, even if it's not price-restricted. So you change the way the market is by allowing for higher density when it's a possibility on the land. And you can do that, and it works.
Comment here?
My comment is similar to yours, except that I think instead of allowing for higher density, you require it. You have zoning that's appropriate. And so I do have a question of Dana as to whether he thinks that might be politically feasible. I think that's where the problem is. The tools are there, but they generally aren't used.
I'll pay you later for that question. Actually, the county's housing element has a program that we're going to be testing soon where we're going to map out some areas in some of our unincorporated communities and propose minimum densities.
Okay. Comment over here.
I think we do need to pay some attention to national policies in spite of what I said earlier. One of the things that we just learned last week is that the President's Task Force on Income Tax Reform has proposed limiting or eliminating the mortgage tax deduction, which may have an impact on demand. One of the things that, now you can build all the supply that you want of condominiums, apartments, and so forth. If the demand isn't there, if the demand in this county, if people applying for mortgage loans in this county are looking for large, oversized single-family homes, that's what is going to get built, and that's because that's what's going to get sold. But one of the things that influences that demand a tremendous amount is the availability of mortgage interest deduction. And one of the things that has been proposed now, or it may be proposed, we're not sure, it seems to be being talked about, which is interesting, is limiting the mortgage tax, the mortgage interest deduction to only the first $1 million of a mortgage. That may solve some of our problem. The other thing that might be discussed is eliminating the mortgage interest deduction on a second home. Speaking as a second homeowner, I'd prefer not to see that being done, but that may also be done, and that's one of the things that could also at least slow down the acceleration of that trend, which might result in all of us looking like Carmel or frankly, Pismo Beach, which also has a lot of second homes in it right now. Let's hope for the best.
Any comments from the student table here? Yes.
Okay.
Over there and then back here.
Yeah, I just was thinking that we a lot of our builders are building to the maximum potential of these of various and sundry lots because the lots have a lot of potential because they're pretty large lots in general. But if we were able to have smaller lot subdivisions and only allow a certain size home, I mean, there's a certain number of bungalow courts that have 500 square foot homes that are perfectly decent little houses. That sort of solution would also prohibit people from creating these monsters.
Okay. Comment?
I'm not too sure what all the how all the politics work, but and the building height codes and everything, but it seems like building up might be an option instead of sprawling out. I know the views and part of the city's character is it doesn't really have any tall buildings, but especially for students, if you built, you know, just even a 10-story apartment building or probably would make a big impact. I mean, students, as it is, don't have a whole lot of options of places to live, so I'm wondering if that's even an option.
And so building up is a higher density also?
Yeah.
Okay. Any response on building up question? Yes, from some of the city or county folks?
That's a good point. It's actually a strategy that is going to create a careful look at local policies. San Luis Obispo recently had a planning commission meeting where they considered having a residential condominium building that would be built in order to accommodate higher density housing. But it is going to require that the city look at its desire to, number one, have a compact urban form, accommodate higher density residential development, but also it's those two objectives are kind of at odds with keeping things the way that they are and having a relatively small town character. Planning Commission recently decided that it was in the city's best interest to allow what in essence was a height exception that development was asked for. So we do have a Planning Commission recommendation to support that, but it's going to have to be reviewed by the City Council. And if you're interested in seeing that debate, keep an eye on the newspapers and the public notices because that's coming up in the city of San Luis Obispo very soon.
Anyone else?
Yes.
One
comment over.
Real fast. I think we need to be careful of one size fits all. I think we talked about diversity of homes and so forth. I think we also have to talk about diversity of areas, diversity of demands. And so I know we're working on a housing element in the county right now, and I think one of the primary underpinnings of that needs to be diversity in our approach. As I say, one size does not necessarily fit all, so we have to be careful.
Okay.
Question?
Comment over here.
I guess it is on. I live in Avila, and Avila has a specific plan. The specific plan designated commercial areas with housing above. It was very forward-thinking. It was adopted by the county. Those upper units are now used as vacation rentals. That was not the intent. So I think you have to watch for, yes, you provide housing, but how is it used? It's very disturbing to the people in Avila who spent time with a specific plan and want. And there's a project now on the schoolhouse site. They have stated at the beginning that they are going to have vacation rentals in that unit. That's not the intent. It's very distressing.
Okay. We have one more comment. Yes. Then we'll move on.
I have a question. I'm wondering, who exactly are you guys trying to target with affordable housing, and how do you hope that this is going to impact San Luis with this, these new people coming in, whoever they may be? And is that really going to affect the cost of housing here? Because won't the larger single-family homes still be just as expensive because there'll still be people wanting to pay lots of money to come and live here? So how exactly is it going to affect what's going on?
Anyone want to respond to that question? Dana?
I'll answer it if I can. We're targeting people who have different incomes. So whether they're students or working people, they fall into different income groups, very low income, lower income, moderate income, and some of us are trying to propose a new group we call workforce housing, which is above moderate. And that is additional housing that needs to be provided that isn't being provided yet. Hopefully it won't affect the upper end single family detached homes and cause them to be even more expensive, but it might.
Okay. Dave and John, you've been kind of putting your hands up and down.
I just want to comment about San Luis Obispo City, which I think has created a lot of the housing problems we have in this area. This is the center of government, the center of jobs. Government jobs are here. We're the center of retail. We sell more than most other, the rest of the county together. For a number of years, despite this being a county seat, the city has, for quality of life purposes, very much restricted the growth that has taken place. We have not annexed new areas. We have been very comprehensive, overwhelmingly slow in processing new developments. The Margarita area has been 15 to 20 years in study and process. The Orchid area is more than 10 years projection. All of that creates a very non-response to the housing picture. So we have adopted all the planning principles, affordable by design, smaller lots, all of that, and we are doing that. However, until we finally move ahead, this last month, we agreed to expand our sphere of influence, first time in 15, 20 years that we've done that. Until we finally move ahead with action, the area of San Luis Obispo is simply going to stay as unaffordable for everyone except for the well-to-do or the people who live there. Students have to rely on Cal Poly housing. The working families will still have to live somewhere else and commute into San Luis Obispo. Hopefully, this project, the 2050, will get us started toward quicker action to provide for housing needs in our area.
Thank
that
you.
Wasn't a question. Sorry.
Thank you. No, thank you. I think we've got to move on here. Or
okay.
John, did you want to? Do you have one more comment? It's the mayor's time.
Well, I didn't want to take away from everyone else's discussion, but the first thing I want to know is that young lady's phone number. When I offer her a job, she's asked two excellent questions here today. I'm having a dubious distinction of being an elected official who is a planner by profession, and I work for private developers as well, so I get all three sides of the triangle. I can't answer her question, but what I did want to talk about is I didn't agree with the issue of developers trying to build to the maximum, and Jerry, you can pay me later for this. I think one of the biggest issues that we continue to find is we need to have political will to create the policy to generate housing for each economic segment. There are segments that the market will take care of. There is a lower group in which we've got subsidy programs that will take care of, but how do we deal with workforce housing for police, firefighters, and teachers? One of the issues that the builders, and I'm on a statewide committee, has been talking about is general plan or density certainty. Because what's the first thing a builder does is they go and they think about buying a piece of property. They look at a general plan that says, here's your theoretical maximum. They go back, they do a pro forma, they talk to staff. Staff said, here's your theoretical maximum based upon site constraints. Staff works with them. You get before the decision-making body. The residents come out and they say, this is too dense. I have rarely seen a project that where the general plan says 12 units per acre, what actually gets put on the ground even comes close to that. I think you'd be lucky to get 6 or 7. And so until there is a change in political will and until there is a paradigm shift in saying housing really is important to us and we have a discussion about trade-off factors, meaning, yeah, we all like agriculture, but in what situations is it acceptable to develop certain, whether it's greenfield or infill? So I'm hoping that these discussions will get us to that discussion, not just for the city, but on a region-wide basis. And so the political will needs to be there, and I'm hoping as we go forward there will be more elected officials besides myself and Dave in attendance.
Okay, thank you very much. The next issue that we want to talk about is agriculture.
Thank you, Chuck. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Brenda Auerkirk, our next speaker. Brenda is the Assistant Agricultural Commissioner for the County of San Luis Obispo Department of Agriculture. Brenda has worked for the department for the past 21 years in all program areas, and she now oversees day-to-day operations of the department's programs, which include pest detection and management, pesticide use enforcement, apiary plant inspection, and the department's land use planning program. Brenda grew up on a family farm in San Joaquin Valley and is a proud Cal Poly graduate. She has a degree in ornamental horticulture. Previous to her current career, she worked in the wholesale nursery production industry. Brenda is here today to give us the perspective of the County Agricultural Commissioner's Office and explain the role that they play in the arena of land use planning. Please join me in welcoming Brenda Auerkirk.
Thank you. Good morning. Well, as Chuck mentioned, I am not a planner. I'm an Aggie. And I also realize that we've been sitting here since 8 o'clock this morning, 8:30. So if you promise not to leave, can everybody just stand up and stretch for a minute? I think we need it. And this table gets gold stars. That's good. Okay. Thank you for not leaving. San Luis Obispo County is very fortunate to have a strong, viable, and dynamic local ag industry. The diversity of the crops grown here is amazing. From the obvious ones, we have cattle, grapes, lettuce and broccoli, strawberries, but also the not so obvious ones. We have pepinas and fajoas, and I can tell you later what those are. Looking back 50 years, the county consisted of dryland farming, which was barley, grain, oats, wheat, and garbanzo beans, and the dairy industry dominated the ag scene here locally. We've seen a trend of some of these historic crops being converted to other crops, such as vineyards, obviously, or other land uses, such as rural homes. But we also continue to see the success of the new and emerging crops, olives, baby lettuces, spinach, blueberries, for example, and the evolution of our greenhouse industry. The contributions made by ag are enormous, not only valued at $540 million in 2004, but we've heard today, and just think of some of the other contributions we can attribute to ag. Jobs, local sources of food, flowers, ornamental plants, open space, and the rural, natural character of our county. We have open space that creates the community separators. We have the beautiful views. We have seasonal celebrations and recreational activities, such as visits this time of year to the local pumpkin patch. I truly believe that agriculture touches in some way everything that I love about living in San Luis Obispo County. So where does ag fit into this planning and visioning effort that we're continuing to do, as well as what we're doing this morning? Well, I think the easier question may be, where does ag not fit in? I think we agree it fits in so many places and in so many ways. What does it take to sustain a healthy and viable ag industry? Suitable and sustainable land and water are the most obvious resources. And, importantly, an economic payoff that sustains the men and women and the families that own the land and are produce the things that we love and enjoy here in San Luis Obispo County. And unfortunately, the competition for those limited resources is huge. Land and water, the challenges are very real. Some of the other challenges facing agriculture are population growth and the continuing need for housing, and especially the demand for the rural lifestyle that has transformed the landscape into a mixture of ag and residence, which often lead to conflicts when residential development is in close proximity to ag operations. And on the screen behind me, which by the way is my only slide, I'm pretty low tech, this is an example of rural Arroyo Grande. This is our famous Pike and Elm site in Arroyo Grande. It is an ag zone parcel surrounded, as you can see, by some pretty interesting developments. We see situations such as this all over the county happening. Another challenge is the value of the land itself in many situations now far exceeds the agricultural value of the land. And this has led to the obvious speculative investment of ag and rural land for future development, creating the temptation to divide, develop, convert, and sell. So what are the effects of the competition for these limited resources? Well, a frequently asked question that we struggle with here in the Ag Commissioner's Office is, how many acres of ag land have been paved over? How much have we lost? How much of our farmland has been developed or converted? Well, that's a very difficult question to answer because it's very hard to track and map changes in ag use. But we do have one tool that can help us answer this question. In 1982, the California Department of Conservation Farmland Mapping and Monitoring Program started to document changes in ag land throughout California. And they did this by comparing aerial maps, soil maps, GIS files, and also collaborating with ag commissioners' offices and other agencies throughout the state for the local knowledge. And according to their analysis, in San Luis Obispo County, we see a trend over the last 21 years, approximately 1,700 acres per year converted from intensified ag uses and grazing to what they classify as urban and other land uses. Now, this represents approximately 0.13%, or a little over 0.1% conversion out of roughly the 1 million total acres of available ag land in the county out of the roughly 2 million acres that make up San Luis Obispo County. Now, I need to make it clear that not all of the 1,700 acres was paved and developed. Urban uses, according to their definition, includes things such as golf courses, industrial uses, including packing sheds, processing plants, which in our case includes the wineries. Other uses includes public lands not suitable for agriculture, the existing road systems, vacant ag and non-ag land that historically has had ag production. And another important factor in their data is, for their mapping system, the available ag land in our county does not include the Carrizo Plains area and all of the national forest areas, which we obviously have some grazing going on. So what's the biggest change that we've seen? What's the trend out of that 1,700-acre conversion? Well, it's been the demand and the increase in the low-density rural development. That is, converting ag land that has been in production into the smaller parcels for rural residential uses. What's the Ag Commissioner's role in preserving and protecting agriculture? Since the mid-1980s, our department has been trying to preserve ag land through our role in advising the planning department and others on the negative effects of encroaching rural and urban residential areas onto the ag operations. Our underlying goal is to preserve ag land by raising the issues of the impacts of growth throughout the county's land use planning processes and during the development of land use policies. For example, we make recommendations such as buffers, vegetative screening, and other ways on development proposals to reduce the likelihood of conflicts between residential and ag use. We evaluate the long-term implications of subdivision or zoning changes, keeping in mind always that land needs to be available for the production of food and horticultural commodities. We act in an advisory role in the development of land use policies, and we help implement such policies such as the ag and open space element of the county general plan, which decision makers rely upon when grappling with the complex issues of ag land use planning. We feel our success is the fact that we can provide the information and technical support about the local ag industry to help decision makers make those hard, complicated decisions that and choices that impact the lives of not only the landowners and the people that farm the land, but also the lives of the community at large. And as we're here today to continue to develop the vision for San Luis Obispo County, I believe we need to find the balance between the competition of resources critical to agriculture, again, that is land and water and economic viability, and the needs of this community, housing, recreation, services, and other needs. Now, I'm certain that the development of ag land will continue to occur by the mere fact that in many situations and in the coming future, ag land may be the only place to grow. But the critical need here is to determine how we approach where that development will occur. I certainly don't have the solutions, but perhaps one way to strike the balance between the competing needs could be that more regional approach to planning instead of the case-by-case basis, which often leads to the results we have, the mixed ag and residential uses, and the urban uses in close proximity to ag, or the loss of ag production. And I'm hopeful that through these types of efforts, other local creative approaches will be identified as we continue with the workshops and continue with the planning effort. So what I ask you is go out this weekend, what's left of it, and enjoy the beautiful place that we call home. And as you're out and about, look around and envision what you'd like to see the county look like in the year 2050. And I certainly hope that agriculture is a big part of that vision. So with that, we have some questions for you. Chuck's going to help me out with this. Pick up your clickers, and we'll go from there.
Okay, we have four agricultural questions. And the first one is, how important is the contribution to the local economy made by agricultural operations, in your opinion? How important is it to preserve ag land versus providing additional housing? Number eight. How important is it to allocate water for ag uses versus urban or residential uses? And the last question, the interest in local ag tourism opportunities has increased. Do you agree this is an appropriate use of ag land? Strongly agree to strongly disagree. Is ag tourism an appropriate use of ag land? Okay. How important is the contribution of ag operations to the local economy? Well, this group here perceives it to be very important to critically important. How important is it to preserve ag land versus providing additional housing? Well, we have almost 34% say it's critically important. So again, the bias is to preserve ag land versus housing? How important is it to allocate water for ag uses versus urban and residential? Again, it's perceived to be relatively important to neutral. And do you agree this is ag tourism is an appropriate use of ag land? And again, we have a few people who disagree, but most of you agree or don't care, are relatively neutral on the issue. Any comments or questions? What about water use? Comments with regard to allocation of water to agricultural as a higher priority than to urban or residential use? Any thoughts? Dana?
Another choice that might have been nice, I guess, would be conserving water, since a lot of existing urban and other uses that aren't agriculture use more water than they need to.
Okay. Comment?
The ag community is trying to conserve water as well. So I don't think we could say that it's just urban people who are trying to conserve. There's a lot more drip being used now rather than overhead. So I think the interface, too, that Brenda was speaking about, I happen to serve on the Health Commission, and we've got very involved with the pesticide issue, where the interface between the urban and the... I had a hard time, since I know that the farmer was there first. So I think that it is very important, as she mentioned, to have... the opportunity for the farmer to be able to do his business with some understanding from the people who move in.
Okay. Any other comments or thoughts? Yes.
With respect to water, it's clearly a big difference between South County and North County. In South County, they were wise enough to set aside a good percentage of the Lopez Reservoir to be recharging the groundwater, which makes it possible for irrigated agriculture to continue in the Arroyo Grande Valley. In North County, though, I think the issues are at what point do the wells have to be so deep and the costs of pumping that water for irrigation become excessive for farmers. And that's an issue that they still haven't really wrestled with it, so ways off, but not that far, maybe, because there are, overdrafting the Paso Robles groundwater basin. And I don't know whether that'll be alleviated when they bring in Nacimiento water for Paso Robles, Templeton, or Atascadero, but those communities will be, competing for agriculture. And agriculture, whenever it competes with urban use for water, agriculture is going to lose. They just can't afford to pay that as much for ag. On the coast, of course, the possibility of using desal in the long term is going to maybe save agriculture for those areas too. But we need to, that kind of needs to be dealt with on a watershed by watershed basis, an area by area basis.
Thank you. Any other comments in the back?
The allocation of water between agriculture and urban use is also tied up in some very complex water law, which is you could spend the rest of the weekend talking about. But I think, as with much of what we're talking about today, an educational component is important here. A lot of statistics get thrown out about how much water ag uses. I'm an irrigated orchardist, so I have obvious biases in this, but it takes water to grow food in this part of the world. And so when you start talking about how many acre feet are needed per acre of ag land versus how much is consumed by an urban use, it's going to be more. But that's where our food comes from. And I think there's a lot of the urban population that has frankly become a little disconnected from how its food ends up in its grocery stores, and learning more about that's important.
Yes.
I have difficulty with the basic question, that is a versus, because I think there's enough water in this area for both urban and ag uses. It's a matter of our political will to develop the sources that are there. There's a great deal of state water available to this county if we had elected to take the water, and it's still there if we're willing to pay the price to pipe it. We're in the process of a very expensive Nacimiento project. We still have unallocated water there that we could assign. So it's a matter of priorities for the people who need the water. Are they willing to pay the price to develop it? Eventually, desal will solve all the water problems, I believe. Maybe not in our lifetimes, but sometime in the future. And it won't be versus. There'll be enough for all uses if we're willing to pay the price.
Okay. Any other comments with regard to agriculture? Yes, ma'am. Here you go.
I was just curious about how much of the agriculture is imported and exported, and if we're efficiently using that agriculture here, or how much is, or I don't know if you might have an answer.
So the question is, are we eating what we grow here? Any? Brenda?
Yes and no. We have a huge export market. Most of the broccoli, for example, grown in South County goes to Japan. We do have, of course, the strong farmers market industry here in the county, so a lot of it does remain here. A lot of it is brought over from the valley into the farmers market as well. So it's kind of a mixed yes and no question.
So the stores, the grocery stores and so on, where people get their produce other than the farmers market, may or may not be grown here?
That's correct.
Okay. And last question for agriculture. Any last comments? John?
Yeah, I'm glad to see there's a representative from the Ag Commissioner's office here. And do you mind if I call you Brenda, because I can't pronounce your last name? I think there's a countywide perception that the Ag Commissioner's office has quite a bit of influence when it deals with development projects and housing projects. And so I have maybe three questions, and I'll try to go quickly. The first is, you're protecting ag land, and I don't know if that's class 1 through 4 or 1 through 6. If a landowner decides that they no longer want to farm, do you have the authority to make them do that? I guess maybe the way I'm trying to ask this question is, we're saying let's protect the land, but when a farmer decides that it is no longer valuable to do that and they let the field go, it's open space. So do you have is there a preference and so how do you make someone farm land, or how is that infringing upon their rights?
First of all, when I speak of farmland, I don't make the distinction between prime ag, prime soils. I look at farmland as anything that can support a crop. For example, most of our vineyards are grown on very marginal soil types, soil classifications, just because vineyards love that kind of soil. So I do not make the distinction between prime versus all the other types. The second part of your question is, can we make somebody keep farming that land? No, we cannot. Conversely, there luckily is no requirement for a permit to farm. Anybody can pretty much plant and grow anything in the county, as long as it's legal. It's got to be a legal crop.
Great, thank you. No, and I'm sorry, I asked that question awkwardly, and I'm sorry about that. The last question I wanted to ask was, and I'm not going to give specifics, but I've seen situations in which a potential project has come forward, an issue of secondary access came up. One of the potential solutions talked about running a secondary access through on an existing ag road, and there was very little discussion because the perception was that the Ag Commissioner's office would not accept that. So at what point do you consider public safe and healthy and health with respect to maintaining ag? Do you often get those kind of questions, and what's your position on that?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Is it the impacts of housing next door to an field?
Well,
as
I guess
far
maybe,
as the ag practices
maybe the question
go?
Is, and maybe there's a perception, do you protect, is it your office's goal to protect ag at all costs? Maybe that's more of a pointed question. And all costs means if there's an opportunity to provide safe emergency access, but the trade-off is that it has to go through ag fields or an ag road, How would your office view that?
You know, I want to punt to the planner on that, but there's always trade-offs. And certainly we have to look at the big picture as well. But we do focus on preserving the ag land, but certainly public safety is one of the overriding considerations. Yeah.
Okay, yes, one last comment.
I was just wondering how much the environment was taken into consideration. There's a lot of pesticide and fertilizer runoff, and most of the agriculture in this area is next to a lot of really important, fragile ecosystems, and I'm wondering what kind of laws and what mitigation is taken into consideration to protect these systems from all the runoff and pollution.
We could do a whole day of the review of the regulations, and Bruce, the producer in the room, can concur on that. There's definitely environmental evaluation with pesticide use, fertilizer runoff, and that sort of thing. There's a whole plethora of regulations that govern that, and our department is responsible for enforcing and monitoring and following up and doing unannounced inspections on growers whenever pesticides are being used. There's also something called the Ag Waiver Program that is addressing runoff, and I'd be happy to spend time with you outside of this forum to explain those to you.
Okay, we have two more issue areas to address before we adjourn. And the next area is transportation.
I'm going to avoid, is this mic on? I'm going to avoid this time having to start five times. Steve DiVincenzi just pointed out to me that I'm introducing the next speaker, so I'm going to do the best job I can. Our next speaker is Ron DeCarli, and Ron is the director for the SLO Area Council, and I'm actually excited to introduce Ron because I was involved in bringing Ron here many, many years ago. We both worked in another county, and we were working on some offshore oil issues, and Ron and I got to talking, and we were able to bring Ron up here, and from there he moved to the Area Council and has been there 20, 25 years, something like that. They're really charged with helping the county and the cities together look at regional issues, both in the transportation realm, when we have to do our housing allocations, and actually with regards to this forum, the Area Council has been instrumental really in looking at and making proposals for these visioning efforts. And I would say we're one of the first rural county areas to take a look at a region-wide visioning effort. A lot of the big urban areas have been working on this for quite some time, but we're one of the first, and I think really pioneering some of those efforts. So hopefully we'll learn some lessons from the urban areas and maybe invent some lessons from the experience we have here. So with that, Ron DeCarli.
Thank you very much, Pat. I really appreciate coming here today. I am going to focus strictly on transportation. Our agency is involved with quite a few other things, and it's really a prime partner on this whole Vision 2050 program. Overall, our quality of life, is largely dependent upon having a good transportation system. As our population increases, our mobility is threatened. As you've already heard, vehicle miles traveled is increasing faster than population. Our funding is flat for various improvements. We have significant challenges in terms of policy choices. We have significant challenges in terms of funding. Our agency has also recently adopted smart growth principles, which is largely consistent and has been worked together with the county and their smart growth principles. We are looking at things very comprehensively. Do we know where we're going? Do we have a vision? Yes, we do. The vision the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments has for transportation is to create a fully integrated and intermodal transportation system facilitating safe movement of people, goods, and information within and through the region. Pretty lofty vision, But I think it's one vision that also could pertain to today, could pertain to 50 years from now. It's supported by 8 transportation goals on mobility, accessibility, safety, livability, some of the things we've been talking about here. I'm not going to go through each of those. There's a whole series of programs to implement each of those various goals. Equally important, and almost surprisingly, California is now beginning to also create a vision statewide. It's called Go California. It's just being unveiled now in a series of workshops throughout California. It addresses the 20-year needs to reduce congestion below today's levels. Pretty lofty objective. Deploys demand management strategies, uses existing capacity more efficiently, and build a world-class transportation system. Perfect. That's what we'd like to see here. That overall objective, interestingly enough, consists of a very comprehensive integrated transportation system as an overall objective, looking at highways, goods movement, passenger rail, local streets and roads, public transit, bike paths, pedestrians. California is now looking at all those different modes. There's a large pyramid here also, looking at system completion, operational improvements, intelligent transportation system, smart land use, again being pushed at the statewide level, maintenance and preservation system monitoring. I'm raising this because as we compare with our goals, the goals we've established for the last 8 years are almost exactly the same position the state's moving in now. We are now in sync. We need to look at how we fund these. We need to look at how we prioritize these various improvements. I would say in the past, California's had this backwards in terms of this pyramid, and I think we're moving more towards what we see today, hopefully. So where are we going? With highways, streets and roads, transit, strategies to meet demand, rail and aviation. That's what I'll be discussing next. On highways, streets and roads, we anticipate over the next 20, 40 years, we will modify all the interchanges in our county. We will assure each of them could accommodate expansion to an eventually 6-lane. We'll construct operational improvements throughout the entire system. We will improve, and we have to improve and create a good arterial and collector system so that the whole system works together. We need to look at multimodal opportunities, public transit, bicycles, pedestrians, the entire network of making the whole program work together. And we need also to maintain the system. So here in San Luis Obispo central area, kind of the center part of our county, San Luis Obispo area is the center, the economic center, the geographic center, the job center, 40% of the jobs, 18% of the population. That's probably one of the problems we have with congestion. We have commute impacts on 227, on 101, on Los Osos Valley Road. We generally are addressing most of those in a variety of ways. 227, we have plans. Highway 101, we're working with the city on improving a lot of the interchanges. We have some significant problems on Highway 1, Santa Rosa, throughout from Highway 101 to the city limits. And at this point, in the next 50 years, it's very unclear where we're going on that one particular area. Transit issues. Where are we at with transit? We have 11 different transit systems in our county. We will need to be balancing off those services. We need to look at funding. We have some trade-offs between looking at regional systems versus local systems, and how do we integrate those two? And over the next 20 years, 30 years, we're going to be really focused on specialized transit for the elderly and handicapped versus general public transit. And finally, and most importantly, as we start looking at smart growth, transit rail is largely dependent upon good land use planning and increased intensification of land uses. It simply is not cost effective to provide transit on low density areas. Strategies to manage demand. What we need to do is continue to increase options and choices for everyone. There is no single answer. We need to maximize our choices. Public transit, vanpool, shuttles, increase and integrate park and ride lots as a system, expanding all rideshare programs, completing a local and regional bike network like the Bob Jones Bike Path, the Railroad Bike Path, creating these, the Coastal Trail, creating and linking the entire county into a whole system of bike paths, multi-use paths, etc. And finally, and most importantly, just to complete a regional integrated multimodal system. On rail transportation, what do we expect? Increased speeds, reliability. We still have a system that was built largely 50 years ago. We can do a lot better. We're looking at increased services between LA and San Francisco. We'll be looking at increased services between here and San Diego. Are we going to have light rail in our county? 20 years, 30 years, 40 years? In all likelihood, not a chance. You need intense development for such a program. I hear about it all the time. We need to look at rail and transit in our county and light rail to Morro Bay. I don't think so. However, one thing we do need to look at, and we're continuing to track, is what you see down here at the bottom. Small diesel self-propelled units that could run on existing tracks, holding 150 people, transporting perhaps Santa Barbara to Paso Robles, with stops at every single area. Very fast, very inexpensive. It's something we're tracking. It is also dependent upon land uses around the stations. It is a viable option that is being considered elsewhere. It's something we could consider here. In aviation, we'll be looking at increased flights and destinations. Hopefully back to Sacramento, which we do not have now. We'll be looking at regional jet services. We have some of that now. It will become a mainstay in the future. And in all likelihood, we'll be looking at commercial services in the city of Paso Robles. Kind of a real key issue is the future is largely dictated by today's decisions. There are some transit options that we need to address over the next 20 years. Are we going to look at small incremental growth? Are we going to look at a significant expansion in transit? Or are we going to go full bore and try and develop bus rapid transit systems and express services? Those are some key policy issues that we have. Any significant increases in rail, transit, other alternatives is going to depend on funding, political will, and intensifications of land uses to make it cost effective. Another key fundamental question that our agency will be wrestling with Caltrans and most all of you, what do we do with Highway 101 in the future? There's really two schools of thought, and they're pertinent with where the county goes in the future. One, widen 101 to 6 lanes incrementally. Good example of that is in Santa Barbara. It's now being proposed in Santa Maria. It requires, if we started pursuing down that path, it would take all of our funding, almost all of our discretionary funding, going towards that project. We'd build a little piece at a time. It requires mixed-use, continued trend similar to what you have everywhere else. Alternately, you can develop a comprehensive system approach. This is our adopted strategy. Plan for the eventual widening of 101, 2 6-lanes. All interchanges must be widened to accommodate a 6-lane. Complete our local feeder system, complete our arterial system, complete our frontage roads, complete all of our interchanges, again accommodating at 6 lanes. Expand alternative transportation to their maximum potential, again with bikeways, park and ride lots. Construct an alternative transportation network, and then and only then do we start looking at widening 101. And at that time, then we could prepare a system where we can widen on the inside with high occupancy vehicle lanes to provide additional flexibility in terms of transportation and create a bus rapid transit system, a high occupancy vehicle system. If we don't, we'll be in the same position and replace basically the same mistakes as everyone else. We need to create a transportation system linked to land use, looking at all modes of transportation, and looking futuristically. We do have a vision. We have a lot of challenges. We're going to have a lot of probably some tough choices ahead. But I think there's some good choices, and I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. We have a number of transportation questions. You can, for all these questions, you can blame Steve, because Steve really wants to get a lot of information from you folks. So we'll go through this relatively quickly. We are going to look at three categories of types of projects and activities: highways, streets, and roads, public transit, and bikes and pedestrians. And what we're going to do is actually have you rank each list like we did initially. Oops, I pushed the wrong button. There we go. And like we did initially, on a scale from, in this case, 1 to 8. So if you could take out a pad of paper and a pencil and write down 1, 2, 3, 4, actually start at 8. It's actually right up from 1 to 8. And then prioritize this list. So you would look at this list and pick the item that has the highest priority for you and put it next to an 8. And the easiest way then is to pick the item that has the lowest priority and put it next to a 1. Your second highest priority would be a 7. Your third highest priority would be a 6, and so on. Give you about one more minute. It is a hard one. Steve, do we have this as a handout in our packet? Pardon? If you want to just have it, this green sheet in your packet on the last, actually the third page has the list of items. That helps you a little bit. Is everybody ready to go? Sure. Well, let's wait until we get through this process so we don't distract folks. Okay. Let's go ahead and input your opinions. And the same way we did before, for maintaining and repairing local streets and roads, item A, If you ranked it the highest priority, you'd press an 8. If you ranked it the lowest, a 1, and any number in between, whatever you assign to that particular item. The next one is B, maintain and improve state highways. How did you rank this item? F, relieve congestion on local streets. G, maintain rural roads. And H, expand rideshare options. Okay, now we're going to go through this list one more time and ask the question, how well are we addressing this concern today? So again, on a scale from 1 to 9, where 1 is we're not doing it at all, to 9, extremely well, 5 is we're just getting by. Okay? Go ahead and rate each of these issues. Maintain and repair local streets and roads. How well do you think we're doing today? Maintain and improve state highways. Is number 62 still here or just not participating? Pardon? Left? Okay. Provide passing lanes and turnouts on rural state highways. Improve freeway interchanges. Construct highway operational and safety improvements. And relieve congestion on local streets. Maintain rural roads. And lastly, expand rideshare options. Okay, what this chart shows us is on the vertical axis here is the relative ranking from 1 to 8. So that's the average of the rankings that you all provided to those activities. So in this case, A, maintain and repair local streets and roads, was the highest ranked item. F was close behind. So they're all relatively close from an average of about 3.5 to 5.7. On the horizontal axis is the relative performance, 1 being very poor performance and 9 being extremely high performance. So what we're looking for here are those things that, in this case, This line, vertical line here, is the 5 is just getting by. So we're looking over, particularly in this quadrant, and saying, okay, what is really important and not perceived to be being done well? And in this case, F is the relieve congestion on local streets is the item. And each of those red dots is one of you. One of those red dots is you. So that's the scatter of the opinions in this room. So there's, as you can see, not a whole lot of consensus on this issue. However, on an average, it is perceived to be the poorest performing of all of the items. So on F, what is it about relieving congestion on local streets? Why do people perceive that to be an issue? Yes. Wait for the...
Because it also reflects where you are here. We have spot congestion problems. And if you're in the middle of that spot congestion problem all the time, then it becomes a problem. A lot of the areas, we do not have those problems. So it's a reflection of where you're located relative to spot congestion as well as what your framework is.
So that disparity up here is really a function of, to a great extent, is where you live and how you perceive the problem locally. Yes.
Does lower congestion necessarily mean a better quality of life? Perhaps lower congestion means the cars are going through the neighborhood faster. Is that better? I don't know.
Okay. One more comment on this, and we need to move on. Okay, two more comments.
Well, what it's saying to me is that if we are going to be successful in increasing densities in existing urban areas, and this relates to what Jerry said, we are going to have to address the issue up front of how that's going to affect the traffic on the local streets.
Okay. One last comment back here.
It seems to me that part of the problem is the wording. The item of relieve congestion, everybody thinks that's highly important, but if you instead said improve capacity or expand capacity of local streets and roads, I don't know that it would have gotten the same kind of ranking, too. Everybody's in favor of relieving congestion, but it's a question of whether you're talking about wider streets or fewer cars or just what. You know?
Okay. Ron?
The other major critical issue relative to smart growth is how you develop your transportation system. If you concentrate all your choices into one or two choices or one or two corridors, it doesn't matter what kind of growth you're going to have, you're going to have congestion. If you decentralize it and or maximize choices in terms of mode choice as well as alternatives in terms of driving ability, you will disperse that and maximize your opportunities. That's what smart growth is about. It's about maximizing choice and diversity.
Okay, I'd just like to point out real quickly what's on the bottom. Maintain rural roads. G came out last as far as the ranking. Provide passing lanes and turnouts on rural state highways. Expand rideshare options. Construct highway operational and safety improvements. Maintain and improve state highways. Improve freeway interchanges, and the two highest priorities, relieve congestion on local streets, and maintain and repair local streets and roads. Okay? Let's move on to the next item, and that is public transit. We have four items on this one. If everybody grab their this green sheet out of your packet, this will work better for you. So grab the green sheet and go to the front of the second page. Okay, under transportation, and here's a list of, you can see the list of the four public transit items: improve local bus service, improve countywide bus service, provide lower public transit fares for elderly and disabled, and improve passenger rail service in the county. If you would... And we don't have expand rideshare options on there, do we? You want to put that on, Steve?
Yeah.
If you would take a look at this green sheet, and again, on a scale from 1 to 5, put your highest priority as a 5, your lowest priority, put a 1 beside it, and so on and so forth. Is everybody ready to go? Nope. Okay. Your highest priority should be a 5. Your next highest priority a 4, and so on. 1 5. You only get 1 5. Did everybody recalibrate? We'll vote. We'll start this one over. Okay. Here we go. So everyone put in their answer again. Number 114. There we go. Improve countywide bus system. Provide lower public transit fares for elderly and disabled. Expand rideshare options. Improve passenger rail service in the county. Now, on a scale from the same scale from 1 to 9, how well are we doing to provide local bus service? How well are we doing on improved countywide bus service, on the countywide bus service? How well are we doing on providing low fares to elderly and disabled? And expanding ridership options. And number 68. Lastly, improving rail service in the county. Okay, and here we see the same type of chart. Highest priorities are B, improve countywide bus system, and A, improve local bus service. And both of those are as far as performance is concerned, at basically the just getting by stage. D is the next level of priority, is expand ridership options, and again, it's at the just getting by level of performance. E and C are the lower ones. E, which has a very low level of performance, is improved passenger rail service in the county, and C, which has the best performance of all of the items, is provide lower public transit fares for elderly and disabled. Any quick comments before we go on to the next group? Yes.
I guess the question that occurred to me is, how many of us in this room know much about the bus system? I mean, I couldn't answer a lot of those questions because it's been 20 years since I rode the bus. So maybe this is a better representative crowd, but I felt like I couldn't answer how we were doing.
You were basically answering based on your perception.
I just stopped answering because I didn't have anything to contribute.
Okay. You gave away your keypad number, too. Yes.
How many people?
Need a microphone. Go ahead.
How many people in this room ride the bus or ride their bicycles regularly?
How many people ride the bus or bicycles regularly?
Good. Wonderful.
We got a whole table full over here. Okay. Well, let's move on to the next item. Yeah, I'm going to get rid of this one right here. There, now the lists are the same. It's the easiest way to do it is on this list, write a 4 next to your highest priority and a 1 next to the lowest priority on the list, and then fill in the rest. Everybody ready to go? Okay. From an important standpoint, how did you rank this item? And ignore the 5 and 6. So 1, 2, 3, or 4. How did you rank maintain and improve local pedestrian and bicycle facilities? 1, 2, 3, or 4. Create countywide recreational trail system. And establish safe routes to and from schools. Or 135. Okay, how well are we addressing regional bikeway system today on a scale from 1 to 9? How well are we addressing local pedestrian and bicycle facilities, maintenance and improvement of those facilities? How about the creation of a countywide recreational trail system? And lastly, establishing safe routes to and from schools. Okay. And in this case, Keep in mind on this scale, the 4 would be the highest priority. B, maintain and improve local pedestrian and bicycle facilities. The maintenance of those facilities is the highest importance, and right now you'd rank it as just getting by. D is next highest, establish safe routes to and from schools, slightly less than just getting by. A is create regional bikeway system. And last, C, is create a counter-ride recreational trail system. So that's basically how you've ranked those issues. Ideally, if you look at this kind of profile, what you would like to see are the highest priority issues over here in the 7, 8, and 9 level, and your lowest issues probably down in this area, performing more than adequately, but not necessarily performing extremely well. So that's how you would balance your resources, is focusing in the ideal circumstance. You'd have sort of a rainbow in that right-hand quadrant with everything that's most important performing very well and those things that are lesser importance performing adequately. Okay, let's go on to our next and last area, and that is environmental. So who is going to do our introductions for our environmental speaker?
I think we've got John Ufrat coming up right now.
Thank you. And we've saved the best for last. My name is John Ufrat, and I manage long-range planning programs for the county. And I want to tell you that the kind of input and data that we're getting today is going to be invaluable for us as we move forward in our long-range planning program. We have a number of opportunities to be able to implement, we hope, some programs that will actually make a lot of improvements to the county, we hope. But we're very lucky to have Mr. Ray Belknap here, thousands of acres that have been preserved and protected in this county, and he has a number of really smart strategies, I think, in terms of where we're heading in the future. So let's give a hand to Ray Belknap.
Thank you, and hello, and congratulations for sticking it out the whole morning. Last but not least, kind of reminds me of a story when I was teaching back east. There was a law professor who had been teaching land use law for a generation and always liked to talk about the history of zoning and the importance of zoning and the general plan as the control of land use. And so I set in on a lot of his classes and finally had to remind him of the Endangered Species Act. Sometimes, alas, is not which comes first and which comes last. Is the environment the last consideration of the day, or is it the control up front? That's the big issue. Frankly, I hope at the end of this to emphasize that conservation and environment is equally important part of an integrated vision. It's not separate. There are a whole number of ways to go about protecting land and open space. Gifts, dedications, extractions, development conditions. But probably the one subject that dominates most of the discussion is money. How do we raise money for conservation? So I would try to focus on that one particular issue, particularly regarding the concept of a vision. Talking about a vision is my favorite topic, and I can't tell you how glad I am to see this word vision as part of the title of this meeting. The point of my presentation is to emphasize that having a conservation vision is the answer to raising money for conservation. Period. That's the whole story. And I'm going to illustrate, you know, from some examples, different kinds of visions and how they've influenced conservation of open space. Because the second part of my message is that if we are going to be effective in achieving our own local conservation vision, the importance of the vision increases exponentially. For example, this is a picture of the Dune Lakes area down on the Poma, which probably none of you have ever seen before. but it's an example of a resource, coastal dunes, wetlands, water, that's extremely high on the national vision. This was the money that purchased this was provided by the federal and state government because it was high on their vision. You probably, it didn't require a local vision group because, you know, it was their vision. We were happy to be helpful and implement it, but it was their vision. It's a great vision. I'm not opposed to the vision. It was a great resource to protect. But it wasn't necessarily, you know, our vision. Going on to a second example where we're beginning to make a transition from a totally national vision to a local vision. Protecting the Estero Headlands north of Cayucas was easy, relatively easy in terms of raising money because it's high on the national and state vision. But it began to be a conflict for the first time here with the local vision because Cayucas was not necessarily convinced having a state park here, which is who owns it, with the trailers and with all the use, wasn't necessarily their vision. Their vision for that property was open space, to be kind of like it is today, but being able to walk on it. And I'll tell you, Cayucas went through an extensive and intense process of creating its own vision for that piece of property. It was a kind of a first clashing of national and local visions. The result was that actually a conservation easement was recorded on the property. A new organization called the Cayucas Land Conservancy was created to hold that conservation easement. And now this property is restricted to exactly what it looks like today. But it was an interesting exercise, particularly for me, to see a local vision taking on a state vision and seeing how it would be reconciled. Perhaps closer to home, we have the Gaudete easement. It's just south of the San Luis Obispo Airport. And now we're moving over towards how a local vision can help drive a national vision. It was because the city of San Luis Obispo had its green belt vision. It articulated it, set priorities, had a business. It was then able to leverage the National Fish and Wildlife Service with additional money to provide more protection. And this is the kind of model I'd like to see more of in the future. So not only do you have national organizations have their vision, state agencies have their vision, we're beginning to have local agencies have their vision, and even private organizations, thank you, sir, suffering along with me. And David and Luz, now that I'm retired, I can tell all kinds of stories and say controversial things. But the David and Lucille Packard Foundation a few years ago decided this would be a great county to help spend money in to protect open space. And I was invited to make a presentation, which I did, on our wonderful resources. But they said, look, we don't want to get a lot of applications from everybody. We want to direct the money to the most important places. So they entered into a contract with the Nature Conservancy, applied for a grant, entered into a contract with a local planning firm, and did their conservation plan for the county. Now, while the Packard Foundation criteria said scenic resources, the Nature Conservancy has their own very clear vision of what they want to do, and that's protecting biological diversity, the rare plants and animals, which is incredibly important. But during the course of the year while they did the study, I can't tell you how many times they said, well, all natural areas are very scenic, so therefore we don't have to consider scenic resources. The Moros, for example, never made it into the final report. But an area like Irish Hills was included, and now activities are taking place to protect this large ranch in the Irish Hills. Let's see. But now, moving down to the local perspective and something we have more experience with, I had more experience with, the community of Napomo is an example of an unincorporated community that's been extremely active in developing its own conservation vision now for several years. With funding provided by Save the Mesa, the Land Conservancy went about a number of community meetings to identify what it is they wanted to protect. Now, the kinds of things we see emerging from that local vision not necessarily find its way onto the Federal Register or the California Coastal Conservancy list or anything, but there's a little... does this have a... There's a little tiny piece of property right here behind Old Town DePomo place where several creeks come together. It was an area where it had been subjected to considerable flooding over the years, wiping out that little area. We were able, that little tiny spot turned out to be one of the most important places DePomo wanted to protect. So that then started to drive us to look for grant sources to see if we could find where the local vision met the state vision. And that in the future is going to be a big part of how conservation is done. We were able to eventually find funding from the Department of Water Resources under a flood protection program to protect the community resource that they wanted. They're now going about protecting the Dana Adobe, which is, you know, a critical... What'd I do? Help me out here. Get me back on track. Well, anyway, the Dana Adobe sits right here, a famous, you know, of the Dana family, and it's one of their most important resources. But it's probably the best local example where an unincorporated organization, just from community support, is creating its own vision. Closer to home, this is property Land Conservancy recently acquired along Highway 101 west of town or south of town, the farm fields, the creek. And I put this up because probably it's an example of what we're going to have to see in the future in the way land and resources are conserved. Not only did we have to then combine visions, if it's a part of the city's Greenbelt vision, it's part of the Bob Jones City to the Sea recreational trail vision, it's part of the vision to save habitat for the steelhead, it's part of the vision to save agriculture, it's part of the vision by the county to save community separators. And it's the kind of thing that, as a local organization, we find ourselves working the most with. And not only that, and that's where we're headed in the future to protect our resources. Local money, local resources, local support, because we're trying to protect our local resources that are important to us. Now, why protect this one in particular? You may not recognize it as the Manini Ranch, which is just on Highway 1 across from the Men's Colony. And the reason I put that up is to illustrate the central issue that we're facing here and countywide. In the foreground, that entire grassy meadow are five legal lots. They can be built on with no zoning change, no nothing. Sell a lot, build a house. When we did a study years ago about rural growth patterns, we came up with a slogan we used in front of the Board of Supervisors. You have a lot, you're going to have a house. And we showed a picture of a beautiful farmland. We got a lot, it's going to be a house. We showed a picture of a piece of property on the northern boundaries of the county, 15 miles on a dirt road, 8,000 square feet. Got a lot, you're going to have a house. The issue facing the county, and I still think it's true, and I'm kind of the one carrying the banner for this issue, we estimated there's probably 10,000 legal lots throughout the county in excess of what the general plan would allow. You can't unzone them. The one man left I wish I could talk to from the budget guy from the county to say, perhaps if they were to estimate the cost of extending services to those 10,000 lots over the next 20 years, maybe we could take that money, put it up front retire the development on it and save a lot of money. I'm not sure. But the county is not going to look the way it does in the future. And frankly, there's nothing a lot of us can do about it. But in terms of solutions, I would suggest, it was actually Jerry Diefrinder, for a former supervisor who many of you might know, the one that kept reminding me, Ray, the strongest conservation plan you can develop would be a strong development plan. Come up and tell us where you want to build, and help. That will help save the land, the pressure on the undeveloped land for conservation. And I think that's kind of partially true. The demand for the existing legal lots in rural areas, particularly if they're on hilltops, is not going to go away. There will always be people who want those incredibly big houses with those beautiful views, and I wish I could live in some of them myself. But it will take away the demand for the speculative house you find on a lot of the small rural lots, even along Highway 41. If you take the road to Shandon, just where before it crosses the creek there and heads up to Chelan, notice on the right, I don't know if you, next time you make that road, I wish I had a picture of it, but there you have the speculative houses right along the most scenic road coming into the county, and that's what you're going to find a lot of places, including here, if we don't find a local mechanism for funding the conservation of that land. And that's going to create a strong vision from all of you here. Thank you.
We have a couple of natural resources questions. We'd like to get your input for them. The first one. As we do our high-tech transition here. Flip up the... There we go. The first question is, how important is protection of natural resources in open space on a scale from 1 to 9? Number 21? They have, okay. And the next question is, how well are we doing protecting natural resources in open space? And most of you here feel that protection of natural resources in open space is extremely important, and how well are we doing? We have a mixed bag. Some people feel we're doing pretty well. Others don't feel that way. Okay. Let's go on to our last question, or series of questions. And that is funding. So we've got a list through some form of additional taxes, first of all. And then if so, indicate your relative support for this item. This is sales tax increase for open space. The next revenue mechanism is increased user fees. How willing would you be to support increased user fees to support and pay for open space? As part of a property transfer tax, development fees, Grants. Individual development mitigation, project mitigation. Development mitigation land bank. Purchase of conservation easements. Creation of an open space district. Okay. So this is the average. And the highest support is for grants. It's kind of a no-brainer, isn't it? Use somebody else's money. But it's really your money, eventually. Okay, the next one is purchase of conservation easements. And why don't we just look at it this way? So this is a distribution to purchase of conservation easements. Over 50% have strong support. Creation of an open space district. Individual development project mitigation. Development mitigation land bank. It's part of development fees. Sales tax increase. Property transfer tax. Increased user fees. It's interesting, increased user fees came out last. Any comments or surprises anyone would like to make on the open space issues? Yes? Development fees. Increased sales tax.
I always find it interesting. I represent builders. People are always more willing to charge the new homeowner more than they want to pay themselves, but they're all going to use this. So a real fair funding mechanism is to spread the cost as broadly as possible and not put it on the back of the new homeowner.
Okay. Any other comments? Quickly. One more. Ron?
The issue is so big, you can't just look at one measure. I mean, you really need to look at it comprehensively and maximize all the tools you have.
Okay, Steve, you want to? Oh, you want me to do the survey?
Yeah.
Okay. We promised you to show you the results of the survey. Folks, in the survey, both countywide and in San Luis, gave a higher priority to the lack of well-paying jobs than the participants did here today. And also, too much development in rural areas. The participants today felt that was a higher priority than did either the countywide responses or the city responses in the telephone survey. I'm just going to go through these since we're getting close to time for adjournment. Which of the following best reflects your opinion about how city governments and the county should cooperate on land use and growth issues? Relative priority is the same, but this, you folks have a much stronger opinion than the rest of the county or the city. And again, the countywide and city of San Luis are about the same on all the issues. How small or large an area should planners be thinking about when making plans for housing and job growth? Do you think that the local government should plan to match job growth with affordable housing? Again, the same relative priority. However, the participants here were much stronger about across a wider geographic area such as the North County and regions. Do you think it is better to steer growth toward already developed areas, which both in the telephone survey, the countywide and the city of San Luis were about the same? The participants here felt much more strongly about that. Undeveloped areas, as you note, that you've got 20 to 30% of the folks in the telephone survey said that you would move growth toward undeveloped areas, where nobody here suggested that. Local government should, again, consistent response, plan to retain open land between cities. The meeting participants felt more strongly about that. And about 25% of the telephone survey responses, both City of San Luis and County, also supported allow new cities to develop next to existing ones. Water supply. We have a limited water supply in the county and in the growing need for affordable housing. Which of the options would you be more willing to accept to address these two shortages? In this case, countywide, there was a strong preference for limiting growth to match existing water supply, as opposed to the participants here focused more on conservation. People say there are trade-offs in choosing local community to live in. Which would you choose? More participants, it was almost 50-50. It was about 55-45, something like that. The countywide responses chose single family only, no amenities, versus the participants here had a strong support for a mixed amenities type community. And the other trade-off, whether you'd recommend small lots, we got a typo there, small lots with amenities versus large lots with no amenities. Countywide and in the city, it was about 50-50 split. Again, the participants here feel very strongly toward the small lot amenities, which is more of a smart growth orientation. Do you think that local government should match plans for new housing with plans for job growth in specific areas, or should they plan for new housing even if not many jobs are planned? And again, there's a strong consistency here. However, the county participants, the survey respondents, felt more strongly than the participants here that the county should plan for new housing to match jobs. And this is county and city planning groups are asked to focus on many issues. How would you rank these issues? And these issues were ranked relatively consistently, with the exception of protecting the environment, which was basically second countywide, and in the city was first for this group. And then this group also felt strongly about creating walkable communities. So that's sort of an overview of how you all fit in. For the most part, you fit in quite well, with a few obvious exceptions. Some cases you had stronger feelings than the other countywide respondents, and in a couple of cases they were somewhat different. Got the one last question. Do you want to ask this question real quick, Steve? Yep. One last question. Are you willing to participate in future dialogue addressing growth in San Luis Obispo County?
Are there 2 weeks after that in the South County? We are hoping to build on this. I want to go back to maybe Ray's comments. And Ray got drafted into this right at the end of the line here. Just had a chance to speak yesterday. But I think he hit on what this program is all about, which is we need to develop a more coherent regional vision, because that's where we're going to find money for transportation, for open space, for housing coming from the state and federal governments in the future. And one of the big reasons we're doing this is to get ourselves ready and positioned to be able to take advantage of those things, as well as all the other good benefits we talked about here. But again, I just want to take the from my heart to say thank you very much for coming out and working with us on this. We look forward to receiving the grant money and moving forward next spring with a much more aggressive effort to involve the entire public through a whole series of meetings. So, again, thank you very much.